You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Let's start the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 31st, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Daniel Nikanian, editor-in-chief of Bolt Magazine, to go over some of the most important referendums on the ballot 8 days from today. Then, Christian Smalls, president of the Amazon Labor Union, will be our first in-studio guest in 3 years, aside from Saul. Meanwhile, Lula Livre. Lula wins in a stunning defeat for fascism in an amazing comeback story. Meanwhile, at the Supreme Court today, affirmative action on death watch. The Supreme Court all but sure to gut the remaining elements of affirmative action in higher education and perhaps undermine the entire government's ability to help foster any equity in this country. Russia sends missiles across Ukraine with hopes of freezing Ukrainians into submission. And also look for a massive spike in grain prices to hit after Russia quits the deal that allowed Ukrainian grain to travel through the Black Sea. Going to be particularly difficult for less wealthy nations around the world. Polls showing Democrats with a marginal lead in some of the most important Senate races. A new report overturning Roe has already meant that over 10,000 women were forced to give birth. Florida moves to ban gender-affirming care for minors. T-Mobile workers start an independent union. U.S. deploys nuke-capable B-52 bombers to Australia. That's nice. And Elon Musk planning a massive layoffs at Twitter, potentially before the November deadline, where a bunch of people vest in their stock options.
Oh, that's going to engender goodwill.
And the suspect in the Paul Pelosi attack apparently had zip ties. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is another Monday. We are, like I said, 8 days out from the election, so things are getting a little bit tight. There's a lot of news that we have for today. We also have a couple of guests. And, of course, with me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Great.
I'm fine. But, I mean, great news yesterday. Great, great, great news yesterday.
We opened up the show with a clip of Michael and Jamie from, well, this must have been, when was this?
It was, that's a good question.
What, the
actually.
First time Bolsonaro got COVID? Or
but
the second
it was a
time?
False alarm, actually, that time. That
but
we
were
left.
We in oh. studio at that time?
It looked like it.
Well, yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah, you asked these, and I'm confounded myself, like, because we stopped pretty early before Bolsonaro was doing, huh.
Isn't it weird? Because I was watching it last night, I put it on Twitter, and I couldn't figure out, wait a second, when was it that...
Because he never came back.
No. No, and...
Is Michael doing it from, he's doing it from studio, too.
I think it must have been, yeah, I just don't know when this was from. And I just don't know. We got to Google and find out when Bolsonaro had COVID for the first time. But it must have been before March of 2020. And or maybe in the run-up. I don't know. I don't know.
Looks but like one of the looks like it was July 7th, 2020.
The video was posted, we didn't. Someone else posted it. So
Nevertheless, the point is, Michael was. I mean, I think longtime listeners of the show know how much Michael was invested in Lula as a figure. But Michael also, I think, largely, at least within sort of the confines of the world that we operate in, I think most people really understood the whole sort of both the story of Lula, both the skepticism over Lava Jato very, very early on in that process. Well before the leak of documents to The Intercept and Glenn Greenwald in Brazil. And Michael, you know, I think had the opportunity, I think, of ultimately of his lifetime to go down and interview Lula. It was
March 2020. March 2020.
It was March 2020.
So right
before. It was literally right before
down.
We shut down.
Yeah.
Right. And that makes sense. We just thought we'd open the show that way. To the extent that there is any type of consciousness or life after death, there is no doubt that if that exists, Michael is extremely happy today. It is a great thing for the country of Brazil. It is a great thing for, I think, South America. The entire hemisphere. Yeah. I think it's really important
from like the working people and like their day-to-day life. Like last time Bolsonaro was in charge, like literally poor people grew taller because they're getting nourishment. And also it's good for the Amazon rainforest.
Yeah, good for the planet. So one of the biggest methods of carbon capture and also just beauty in the world is not going to be torn apart for capitalists. At least, you know, as long as Lula stays in power. And also it's just historic given that, you know, this process of their electoral process is fairly young, but it's the first time an incumbent president has lost.
Yeah. And on that note, in terms of like the Michael laugh on that beat, Vincent Bevis tweeted out this morning, after losing the election last night, Jair Bolsonaro apparently isolated himself in the presidential palace, refused to speak with his ministers and went to bed. We haven't heard from him since.
Self-care, baby. I mean, look, you know, he's got
taking a mental health.
He needs a mental health check but then you don't need to check on him, actually.
Here is Lula out with his supporters. It's going to be tougher in many respects this time around for him to have the same impact on the working class, on poor people in Brazil, because he's dealing with a Congress, essentially, that is dominated by both members of Bolsonaro's party and sort of centrists. However, things like the Amazon rainforest is one of those things I think where he has the ability unilaterally to change things. Here he is out, and people are apparently very excited. And just keep that in mind, what Matt had said there, that literally the height of people changed. The physical, like you can literally measure a difference in the height of people because of what he did in terms of bringing just basic nutrition to his people. And the only other point I want to make before we go to a break for a moment is that Joe Biden, very quickly, like within an hour of the announcement that Lula had won, made an announcement, an official announcement of the United States congratulating him. The absence of any wavering on the part of the United States definitely helped shut the door on any plans that Bolsonaro may have had, even his supporters, Bolsonaro's supporters as well. I mean, I think there must have been, you know, more going on beyond this. I don't think that the United States just cut a press release. But I suspect things were communicated like we're not going to tolerate any type of stuff that in the past we may have actually fomented.
Trump could have been in office and saying, you know, we've got to make sure there's no voter fraud or anything like
without
that.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And we saw during, I think, Bolsonaro's term, more confidence on his part to do crazy ass shit, essentially, because Trump was there just going like, go for it.
And honestly, I know, you know, you have people kind of remarking, oh, the margin of victory was not what it was projected to be. But Lula did overcome a lot of efforts by Bolsonaro and his and the people loyal to him to tamp down the vote. And, you know, there was David Adler of Progressive International, right, was basically tweeting that there were reports that the Brazilian army was colluding with federal police to set up barricades to block Lula voters from going to the polls. So despite all that, this was still a massive victory. And, it's definitive from the U.S. That's helpful.
I think Mike Elk was also down there reporting on the same thing. From the Payday report. So yes, there was a lot of attempts to sort of quietly suppress the vote. All right, we're going to take read some words from the sponsor, and then we will have Daniel Nakanian, who will be giving us a sense of the ballot measures across the country that are important to keep an eye out. One of our sponsors today joins me every day, usually in a bottle like this. And I've been on a jag. I don't know what it is, but the immunity one, the tangerine. Mm. I don't know if it's from the flavor. I just keep thinking like, you know, it's getting it to be cold and flu season and also COVID. You know, I want to support my immune system. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you, because they've got all sorts of flavors and they've got like the energy drink one with matcha. Great way to stay hydrated on long flights. Great way to stay hydrated if you are overindulging. And also just important to do in general. Every day now, I drink at least a bottle of this. And that's, I mean, can I sense that I'm healthier? I don't know. I'm also aging, too, so it's hard for me to measure it. But Liquid IV contains five essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. One stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you two times faster and more efficiently than water alone. And with Liquid IV, you get three times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks, but it's non-GMO. It's free from gluten. It's free from dairy. It's free from soy. And as a company, Liquid IV is on a mission to change the world. To date, the company has donated over 25 million servings in 50-plus countries around the world. For me, orange, watermelon, strawberry. But you like the acai, right?
Acai, yeah.
I don't even know how to say that.
Yeah, and but I like a bunch of the other ones. I like strawberry, too, and... yeah.
Kids like the Concord lime. Grape around my house. There's all sorts of different flavors. Doesn't matter. There's no time of the day where you shouldn't be properly hydrated. Grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco or get 15% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MajorityRep, just MajorityRep, at checkout. That's 15% off anything when you order and shop better hydration today using the promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Check it out. Also on the program today, everybody's busy. Everybody's gearing up for the holiday season. We got some gifts today, incidentally. I want to thank listener Chris.
Oh,
maybe
yeah.
We'll just mention that in the fun half. But you're running around. You want to save time. How are you doing that? Well, if you have a small business, you got to deal with fulfillment. Or even if you're just somebody, I guess, who sends off a lot of letters. How are you going to save a little bit of time in your day? Well, I will tell you right now. Because it's not too late to get your holiday mailing and your shipping under control with Stamps.com. Mm. Stamps.com, you get access to the USPS, that's the United States Postal Service, and UPS services you need to run your businesses right from your computer. You can even save money on USPS, that's the U.S. Postal Service postage, and UPS shipping rates up to 86% off. And here's the other thing that I love. You can print postage wherever you do business and whenever you do business. All you need is a computer and a printer. You can do this at 3 in the morning if you want. You can do it at 5 in the morning, 2 in the morning. You can do it. People get the idea, but right. I just highlight the morning. Obviously, you can do it at any time. Stamps.com switch and save feature. You can easily compare carriers and rates. And if you're running an online store, Stamps.com works seamlessly with all the major shopping carts and marketplaces. Hugely important, particularly for people who, we get a lot of people who listen to this program who run their own like home businesses. Fulfillment is one of the trickiest parts of that, and Stamps.com makes it super easy. This holiday season, trade late nights and for silent nights and get started with Stamps.com today. Sign up with promo code MAJORITYREPORT, one word, Majority Report, for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. There are no long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the page, and enter the code Majority Report. We will put all the links, as per usual, in our podcast and YouTube descriptions. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be talking to Daniel Nikanian. He is the editor-in-chief of Bolts Magazine. No one, as far as I can tell, on the planet keeps better track of down-ballot races and referendums than Daniel Nikanian. Like, no one in the world. It's sort of impressive to be that kind of superlative. We'll have him in just a second.
Lucky we have him on the show today.
That's right.
There we go.
Be right back. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Daniel Nikanian. He is the editor-in-chief of Bolts Magazine. And Daniel, I said prior to taking the break, I said, I know of no one else in the world who follows individual races across the country, down-ballot races, particularly in terms of justice reform. Questions, sheriffs and prosecutors, or frankly, ballot referendums like you do. It is always a pleasure to have you here. We should also just say you're not in a sauna. There's a light haze going.
Yeah,
across.
It's a soft lighting.
Soft lighting.
Right.
I understand. I do the same thing to maintain the image. But thanks for joining us.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's go through You have a piece on Bolts Magazine that breaks it down in terms of important issues. Let's start with that. Let's start with abortion, because when Roe was overturned in the Dobbs case, there was, at least on paper, I think it was 13 or 14 states that had trigger laws that would have gone right into effect. Mm-hmm. Some of those did. Some were held up by courts. And then there was an anticipation that we could get up to like 28, 24, somewhere in that neighborhood of states across the country that are ultimately going to ban abortion. We're going to see we're seeing both things sort of happening next week, both enshrining the right for an abortion and an attempt to remove it. Let's go through some of those states.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, one thing to also keep in mind as we discuss this is that the midterms are next week. They were a few months after Dobbs. The sessions in many states are going to start in January, February, and we might see a lot of new bills, a lot of new bills starting in the spring that we haven't yet seen, in part because Republicans don't want to kind of get even more attention to abortion before the election, and in part just because they haven't been in session. And really, the state to focus on this issue is the state of Michigan. It's really the only state that both has a law on the books that would ban abortion. It's been held up in court, which is why Michigan doesn't really have a ban right now, but it's on the books. And it's the only state that has that ban on the books and a constitutional amendment on the ballot that would overturn the ban and enshrine the right to access abortions in the state constitution. So that's just like the most straightforward way possible to explain the importance of abortion on the ballot. Is really the state of Michigan. There are other states like California and Vermont that are trying to do the same, that are trying to enshrine the right to abortion access in the state constitution. But obviously in a state like California and Vermont, we don't have a ban on the books. So it might be important, you know, in the future or depending on what still happens. But the stakes there are a bit different. But, you know, in many...
And let me just explain one thing to folks that... you can have a statute, in other words, just a law that has passed in a state that can enshrine the right to an abortion, but that is subject to 5 years down the road, 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, whenever it is, 20 years down the road, to the state house falling into Republican hands and them reversing it. When you put it in the Constitution, it's genuinely enshrined. It's much harder to change, obviously, because then you need both the state house and the people to vote for it. And we should also say, in the context of Michigan, I think the chances of Gretchen Whitmer being the presidential nominee or vying for it in 2024. In the event that Joe Biden doesn't run, is very much bound up in the success of this ballot measure, because she has basically been running on abortion in a way that I think no one else in the country has been. It seems to me, in a state where it's sort of like vaguely contested.
Yeah. And you know, it's very interesting in Michigan because, I mean, besides the specific measure we're discussing, Michigan is a great exemplar of how many things at the same time are very important to abortion access. There's the governor race, where obviously it matters in terms of a Democratic governor having the power to veto bills that Republican lawmakers might send. But there's also the AG race, and the AG office in the state of Michigan, the Attorney General, has the authority to supersede an elected DA in Michigan, which is not the case in every state, and actually prosecute cases of abortion, even if a prosecutor in Ann Arbor or in Detroit has decided not to. And that the question of abortion access has become an issue in the AG race there. There's also two seats on the state court, on the state Supreme Court, that are up for grabs, and that will decide the majority of the Supreme Court in Michigan. And that, too, very, very obviously will be very important for future cases. having to do with abortion and obviously a whole host of other issues. And it's very interesting how, you know, in one state, there's 3-4 extremely important elections that will in different ways really shape the future of abortion.
Let's move on to voting rights and ballot access. There's, for the most part, I mean, it's, I guess there's a similar dynamic in voting rights. I mean, it's indicative of the country. Like, some states are sort of expanding the franchise or at least protecting the franchise, and others are essentially shrinking it. And we should say, like, this is it's, what's fascinating to me is that this has been going on. Well, I guess it's been going on since, I don't know, pre-Reconstruction. But in the modern era, the Bush administration really pushed this idea of voter fraud happening. And it was tied up in their attempts to fire a bunch of U.S. attorneys. This is in 2004, 2005. And we are seeing sort of like the offspring of that effort in a lot of red states around the country. Walk us through some of these voting rights and ballot access.
Yeah, I mean, what's I think particularly interesting and concerning in our movement is that the all of the talk about fraud that you just described is also paired up with increasingly open an increasingly explicit case on the right that the democracy is not good, that it's not good to have a lot of people voting,
right.
that it's not that we should, like, as a proactive case, restrict voting to get few people to vote. We're seeing that some people say that explicitly. And one thing that's one set of ballot measures that I'm watching with particular interest next week is in Arizona and Arkansas. There are a total across these two states of 4 measures that would make it harder to pass initiatives, to pass, it would be harder for grassroots efforts to take hold or to put initiatives on the ballot and pass them. And we are and that's not anodyne. What we've seen in the past couple of years is a rapid increase in bills to make this process harder, really, in GOP states across the country. Because in states that are heavily gerrymandered or that tend to be conservative in who they elect, this has been the path that the left has chosen to do things like increasing the minimum wage, expanding voting rights, and such priorities. And we're seeing in Arkansas and Arizona a set of measures that would cut that down. Actually, they just tried that a few months ago in South Dakota. And that measure in June, and that measure failed spectacularly, and yet we're seeing it again now, and we will probably see it again. So that's just one kind of one thread of what's happening around these measures, which is making them harder to block the avenue for any of what we are right now discussing.
And that has, I mean, obviously, like, we could see the implications, like in a place like Kansas, where abortion was essentially the right to get an abortion was ratified. But it also impacts issues that are not being addressed, like you say, minimum wage, marijuana decriminalization and legalization. It frankly, the Supreme Court, for all we know, could turn back Obergefell, and it could be a question of allowing for marriage equality. These are also things that tend to, you know, at least some of these things will bring out voters on the left. We have run out of those things, you know, and I guess maybe it could come back with marriage equality and whatnot. But for the most part, these ballot initiatives are trending towards helping Democrats. And so there's an added investment by Republicans to sink that. And I just want to hit one more point, you know, that you made about the democracy thing. Like, you know, people can sort of gloss this over, but in the room with Elon Musk at his, like, sort of like, Twitter brain is this guy, Sachs, who we talked about the other day, very close to Peter Thiel, very close to J.D. Vance, very close to Blake Masters. Blake Masters and J.D. Vance, both running for the Senate, they have both cited this guy, Curtis Yarvin, who is also part of this crew. And Curtis Yarvin is very explicit about arguing that we should not have democracy in this country. And, you know, these there's a lot of these, like, they're Straussians. Many of them come at it in different ways. But there is a legitimate sense that democracy is inefficient, that it allows for voices that we don't want. And we've got, these are not marginal people. They are controlling large institutions that deal with our, with communications in this country. And two of them could be, you know, who are friendly to the idea anyways, could win easily in Senate races this year. So this is a serious issue that is being attacked in multiple ways. And it's not quite clear, I think, to many people, the connections between them. Let's go to drug policy. We had just mentioned that. There's a lot of momentum behind decriminalization, it feels like, right? Like, I mean, the federal government's about to get out ahead of some places.
Yeah, on the issue of weed, and actually that's a great example of what we were just discussing, because there are five states right now where marijuana is on the ballot, and would with referendums that would create legal sales in those states, and four out of five are very red states. They're very conservative. They're very conservative states, and so again, an example here of how this, the path of putting things on the ballot when the state lawmakers are not going to care, are not going to pass something, has been used in red states over and over again, and is probably going to, in most of the states on this list this year, is probably going to pass because it has a record of passing. And you can understand why the whole path of allowing the initiatives is itself right now in question as well.
But it is an interesting, and this is not a ballot initiative, but it's an interesting dynamic where opposition parties in states controlled by one party are using really hot button issues to turn out their voters in a way that they normally wouldn't turn out. Like, we're seeing it in New York with crime. The polls have narrowed for Kathy Hochul because Lee Zeldin has just been hammering crime, and it's trickled down to Sean Patrick Maloney, other Democrats, like, based on early indicators. I mean, what are some of the themes that you're seeing of states primarily controlled by one party making certain cases as a way to benefit themselves, at least along the margins within those contexts?
Or vice versa.
Yeah, right. Well, same thing what he was saying with cannabis in red states, right? But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you just said captures a lot of it. I think obviously the issue of abortion, it seems, I mean, we will obviously know a lot more in 8 days, and it's hard to make fully profound analysis comparing states, but it seems at the moment that Democrats are doing better compared to expectations than redder states and worse than bluer states. And one explanation that's been given is obviously in a place like Michigan or Wisconsin, or places where there's abortion bans on the book, the issue is going to resonate understandably very differently than in California, where, you know, you can point out that a Republican candidate is anti-abortion, but there is no immediate threat in the way that there is in Georgia or a lot of the other states. And so that's one example. And obviously we're seeing a lot of, I guess, in a state like Oregon and Oklahoma seem to be opposite ends of the picture, where there's very specific state-specific issues with that have made the governors of both states very, very unpopular. I don't know quite enough about Oklahoma's political scene to explain why on that one, but that are explaining some of these state-specific dynamics that are going to probably create surprises, at least at the governor level. Next week, and might trickle down at in federal races. Those typically tend to be a bit on their own level.
Well, you know, we spoke to Dave Weigel on Friday, who made that same point that both Emma and yourself echoed, where that we have this dynamic where Democrats seem to be overperforming in red states and underperforming in blue states. And I don't know. To me, that, and particularly in terms of the question of abortion, it is a failure of the National Party to understand that, like, you need to sell in those blue states the national story, which is, you know, and I if the Democrats are going to lose Congress, I hope Sean Patrick Maloney loses, just because I don't like that guy. But the point being that the idea that they can't communicate that, you know, when you don't vote for Sean Patrick Maloney, you are voting for Kevin McCarthy. And if Kevin McCarthy becomes leader in the House and Mitch McConnell becomes leader in the Senate, it jeopardizes abortion in New York. I mean, this is not a hard calculation to make, and it's not in any way fanciful. I mean,
right.
I think that's like as close to the truth as you can get about anything in terms of predicting the future. If you know, and it may not be till 2025. It's a real problem.
Just quickly, John, I mean, that I think that that's right. And I think we are seeing voters behave more and more in line in how they're voting in state races and presidential races, you know, compared to the past 10, 20 years. So, I mean, people are getting that more. But also on the issue of crime as an issue as well, to jump back to what Emma was saying, I think what one super interesting place to look right now is, okay, California is a very interesting state to look on the issue of crime, because obviously there was a huge amount of coverage in June when Jess Aboudin, the progressive prosecutor, lost in a recall. The same day in the LA region, in LA County, the progressives did actually quite well in races where they were campaigning on crime and on potentially even going further or defending the record of the DA there, who's a reform prosecutor, who was facing his own recall effort that failed. And now there's a bunch of other races in a week, including a new DA race in San Francisco, the mayoral race in LA, council elections in LA, judge elections in LA, the sheriff election in LA, where the sheriff there is one of the biggest opponent of reform, and he probably will lose. So there's just a lot of flux, a lot of debate. It's and I think there's this sense that the backlash has won, but there's a very active conversation, debate, conflict happening on these issues in a state like California that is going to be a major theme in the results next week.
How much of that tracks with the idea that when you have a standalone election, where a guy like Sachs, we spoke to Jacob Silverman, I guess it was like last Wednesday, about this guy Sachs. I can't remember his first name. David Sachs, is it?
Yeah.
Who literally accounted for one third of the funds raised to recall Kesa Boudin. Mm-hmm. How much of it is a function of, like, when it's a standalone election and money can pour in because, you know, there's not 30 other races that it's competing for, how much does that have an impact? Like, you know, like these races, you know, in California, you know, county board to remove a sheriff. I mean, they're not going to attract in a midterm where there has been, I think, billions of dollars spent, because there's such an intensity at the House and Senate level that it may not attract, you know, the money that it would have in a less contentious environment. And therefore, it's really resolved more on the merit of the question rather than, like, you know, who has access to the biggest megaphone.
I think it can cut a number of ways. I think there's something to that. And I think a very interesting example to your point is that Alameda County, which is Oakland, which is right next to San Francisco, which is twice as big as San Francisco in terms of how many people live there, if not a little more than twice as big, has one of the most interesting DA races next week, with a progressive candidate who's a civil rights attorney. For a very long time, he's running for DA there and came in first in the June primary and is now in a runoff. She's running next week. You know, I assume that most people who don't live in Alameda haven't heard of that race. even though it has a candidate who's comparable to Boudin, you know, in terms of what, in terms of how she's running, and in a county that is much bigger. I think the interesting question is why some places kind of suddenly get all the attention, and some places do not, even though a lot of the action activism is there. I think the interesting question about the recall was the structure of a recall election and the fact that there is no choice between people, but there is a choice there in Temesco next week, so we'll know more. But to your point, actually, Sam, California passed a law this year, like a month ago, that has moved all DA and sheriff elections to the presidential year, to the presidential election cycle. So starting in 2020, starting in a few years, it will always be on a presidential cycle. And the idea for people who pass the law is that we need more people to vote. Like there's no reason to put these extremely important elections in effectively what's often June of a midterm, where the turnout is a fraction of what it's going to be in the November 2024.
And that's going to, and I mean, I, without even knowing any of the details, just off the top of it, that's going to lead to more progressive reform in criminal justice almost necessarily, right? Because if you're bringing out, presidential level numbers of voters, and that's going to, you're just going to see more Democratic voters. You're just going to see it seems to me that that's probably going to help criminal justice reform in California. Yes or no?
I think that sounds, I would sort of assume, but I mean, at the very least, it allows the argument to be made in front of the biggest base of voters, including the people who are often most affected by these issues and tend to vote more on a presidential year.
Great. All right. Let me ask you, broadly speaking, I want to make sure I ask you about New York State too, because, you know, but broadly speaking, what to you seems to be the most consequential ones? I mean, I imagine we've talked about it in terms of abortion. Are there other ones out there that one would not expect to be so important, but you see that maybe it is more important than people would assume?
On when it comes to initiatives around the country?
Yeah.
I would say, I mean, there's so much. Let me brainstorm a couple that I'd be excited for everyone to know about. Illinois might become the first state to enshrine the right to collective bargain on the state constitution, which, you know, is in the context of around the country, a lot of fights right now around right to work, so-called right to work reforms by the right, but also an assault by the state, by the U.S. Supreme Court around the right to organize in various ways. Obviously, a state constitution cannot offset all that the U.S. Supreme Court will do, but it is an important route right now that progressives are taking to try and strengthen labor rights where they can. So that's interesting to be watching. Just off, this is not possibly probably not the most important, but it just came to mind. Oakland, California is going to vote on this interesting initiative that only right now exists in the city of Seattle to create a program where every resident in the city gets $25 vouchers that they get to give to a candidate of their choice. The idea being to kind of try and find new avenues, new streams to fund local candidates for office. This is all at the level of municipal elections and county elections, to fund the people at the local level from the grassroots, because almost no one, there's very few small amounts of the donors going into local candidates. And we've only seen that in one place in the country, so far, Seattle, and I've been waiting for the past 4-6 years to see if other places in the country are going to try to start bringing this in their own cities and experiment with this as one way to kind of change campaign finance. And yeah, Oakland is voting on that in a week. So I'm interested to see whether that takes hold in California or elsewhere as one way to fund elections.
And is there a sense, I don't know how one would assess this, but how is it working in Seattle?
There've been a fair amount of studies that shows that the studies suggest that it's increased funding for more diverse set of candidates, and it's have more a different set of backgrounds, and has slightly diminished the share of the contributions that have come from very big donors. But it's only been for about 4 to 6 years that it's existed in Seattle, again, nowhere else. So I'm very interested to see if it comes to Oakland.
All right, great. So lastly, New York State. New York City's got four ballot measures, but New York State has one, as far as I can tell, having just voted. And that is a $4.2 billion bond to finance essentially conversion to green technologies?
That's my understanding. Yes, proposal one or question one. I'm not sure I can speak that much more to it than what
All
you
right.
said.
Well, as far as I can tell, it looks good. So that's the idea, because people are always asking me. And as far as I can tell, that looks good. I haven't dug into the New York City ones yet.
There was this very strange decision made in New York State that you remember if you saw your ballot last year, of putting a bunch of very important voting rights measures on the 2021 ballot.
That was one of the greatest F-ups in the history of New York State. It we're still feeling the impact of that.
There was something about
we're going to feel it in Congress.
Yeah,
that's the reason why we have all these weird new districts, is because there was a failure of the New York State Democratic Party to communicate to people how important this redistricting provision was. And there was a couple others too. I can't remember off the top of my head.
There were things about expanding the ballot access, because New York has in many ways pretty restrictive rules. It's just the decision to put it in 2021. I mean, we were just talking about lower turnout in off your elections. We're talking about how California moved it from the midterms, which are still bigger midterm, to a presidential election for some stuff, and then New York put it on the 2021 ballot, which was already strange.
And it was like in August or something.
And then there was almost no campaigning, almost no spending around it. And then they all failed because Republicans did upstate have some campaigning. Yep. Very strange set of decisions. And now this year is only one ballot measure in New York, correct.
And I think strange being like super suspect, to be honest with you.
I also haven't done enough reporting, but I haven't seen much. It is very strange. Now I'm waiting to see if it's going to come back, because it isn't on the 22 ballots. There was some noise about trying to revive these measures. So perhaps we'll see it in April of 2023, or a random date over Christmas in 2025. We'll
right, exactly. Daniel Nakanian, Bolts Magazine. Folks, go over there. You get a full accounting of the ballot measures to watch around the country, and you can learn about the ones in your state, so that when you get into the voting booth, you're not surprised, and just basically take a guess as to what you should be voting for. Daniel, always a pleasure. Really appreciate it.
It's really great to join both of you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back in studio, our first in-studio guest in 3 years, Chris Smalls, president of the Amazon Labor Union, will be joining us in just a moment. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome in studio, we're just saying, our first in-studio guest in 3 years. Couldn't be happier to have it be you, Chris Smalls. He is the president of the Amazon Labor Union. Chris, welcome to the program.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right. So let's, I don't know, you want to work backwards, or maybe we can, let's just start a little bit with the first vote that you guys took in Staten Island. There were two warehouses, JFK 8 and LDJ 5. What were the differences? One was successful, one was not, or at least in terms of the actual vote. Give me your assessment of, like, what was different in those two situations.
A lot of things. JFK has been around since 2018. LDJ 5 is fairly new. I want to say they just opened in 2020. So that's the difference right there. You know, the veterans that organized JFK 8, we're talking people that's been with Amazon 3+ years. Some of them even 6 years, going on 7. LDJ 5 is a brand new building. The organizers that were in that building were new to the company and also new to organizing. They never organized anything of this magnitude. So, of course, we didn't expect to win. We expected to really just, you know, punch Amazon in the face again and really show that, you know, we ain't backing down. And, you know, win or lose with these campaigns, you know, just to have the opportunity to vote, that's already a victory. So we don't, you know, I know the media and the outside community, they calculate, you know, wins and losses.
Right.
But we're talking about workers. You know, there's no loss for the worker. Like, you only lose when you give up.
And so I want to talk a little bit about, like, your organizing background and then I want to move forward and talk about whether the dynamic of having people, workers who both have more experience at the company and therefore probably a broader set of complaints, and also better relations with each other as a way of organizing. But what was your organizing background as you went into this?
That's the beauty of this. I didn't have any. You've been covering me since 2020. You know, I just got fired in the pandemic. Didn't have any intention on unionizing anything. So, you know, our campaign, the Amazon Labor Union, you know, we just won in April, you know, and we've been campaigning for 11 months. So we started in 2021. And we successfully voted in 2022. Before that, prior to that, nobody on my team had any union organizing experience. Everybody was just an Amazon worker who were tired of being mistreated throughout the pandemic. And when we saw Alabama lose, you know, from visiting the warehouse ourselves, we decided to try our efforts. And that's exactly what we did.
So you did go visit Bessemer in the run up to that election?
Yeah, the first campaign. Yeah, we went down there. Me, along with Derek Palmer, and three other Amazon workers, we went down to the first campaign to see what was going on, and we saw that you know, there's a lot of opportunities and missed opportunities with the union and with the workers. So, of course, we wasn't going to make that same mistake. So we came back and we said, you know, let's just try to form something that's going to work for us.
And was being an independent union a part of that? Was that something that you had in your mind from the outset? Or was that just something that it kind of, you know, it worked out that way?
No. We already knew just before we decide to go independent that, you know, the established unions, no disrespect to them, but, you know, Amazon's been around for 28 years. You know, there's been several opportunities to organize Amazon. You haven't heard about them because the established unions weren't able to even get those campaigns off the ground. There's actually two efforts prior at JFK that some people know about, some people don't. I could tell you I worked there and I haven't even heard about it until recent, you know, after I was fired. So that just tells you that the established unions were organizing just incorrectly in traditional style, which wasn't really resonating with the workers. So going independent, being an actual Amazon worker, we know ins and outs of company. We know the grievances. We know the language. We live them. We live these realities every day. We didn't have to educate ourselves on Amazon. You know, we would have had to do that with an established union. We'd have had to tell the Teamsters about Amazon. We'd have had to tell the RWDSU about Amazon before even talking about a union. You know, so like we skipped that whole process. We're saying we're the workers. Now we just have to educate ourselves on how to form a union, which is really easy. You know, that's just collective bargaining, right? Collective power. So we did it reverse style, and we walked and chewed bubblegum at the same time.
How much of so you guys were able to be both more nimble in some ways, but also more specific to your circumstances, both in terms of like what you had been dealing with from the company, but also the best time to talk to your fellow workers is at this point in the day, because this is when we get 15 minutes to walk around or whatever it is. How much of that is translatable? How much of that is translatable to other Amazon facilities? And then how much of that is translatable to other non-Amazon facilities, right? Like, you know, there's like two sets of like sort of questions there.
Yeah. So, you know, with our campaign, of course, being a company like Amazon, we had to do it, you know, just non-traditional and really play chess with them. I spent over 300 days at the bus stop, and I, you know, I can't say how other campaigns are supposed to be designed. But that was a part of our, that was a huge part of our victory. You know, me being at the bus stop while the inside crew, the current workers, were able to go inside and communicate with workers throughout the day and on break and before and after shift. Those few minutes every day were vital. And I think that just goes for any campaign. The only way you defeat the corporation is by having several conversations, not just one. And you have to be available for these workers when they're ready. It's not about when you're ready. It's about when the workers are ready. So we had workers walk past us with 2 to 3 months, didn't even say a word to us. But on that third month or fourth month or whenever, we were there. So it was just more of the longevity game, the long drawn out game, the calm, cool, collective route, showing workers that we care, earning their trust, building relationship up. Meanwhile, Amazon is just drilling, and really forcing workers to really be subjected to over 3,300 captive audiences that they didn't choose to be in. And that also helped facilitate workers towards the union, along with myself being arrested and the other demonizing tactics they used. Workers saw through all of that. They saw that, you know, how could somebody that's being painted out to be so, you know, ugly by the company be at the bus stop, taking time away from his children, his family, doing this. He doesn't even work here anymore, along with the other folks that are sacrificing their time away from their family. You know, that bigger picture started to resonate more.
That's interesting. So it's really, you're almost operating on a cognitive dissonance that where you just the presence there and the way that you guys are acting is making the company look suspicious in the way that they're painting you guys.
Right. You know, no, we wasn't going to beat Amazon by money. You know, no amount of money in the world, can stop people when they come together, though. And that's what Amazon can't calculate. They can't calculate, and they're still trying to figure out how did we defeat them. You know, they look at a spreadsheet, and they said, okay, we're going to have 100 captive audiences this week. We're going to spend X amount of dollars. We're going to bring in this amount of people. You know, we're going to do this amount of propaganda. You know, we look at people by individuals. And what we saw was, you know, one worker not being accommodated for, another worker, you know, same thing, just not being taken care of, not being heard. And we were there to listen. We were there to support them. And we also helped out in whatever way we could financially, you know, paying medical bills, paying phone bills, cable bills, even the Uber ride to and from hospital or to and from work. It was the little details like that that mattered, and that still matters. Amazon will never care about little details like that. They only care about putting profits over people.
Well, they have, like, immense resources that also allows them to maybe eat some of the NLRB fines, if that's the case, right? So they can do these captive audience meetings and still just do blatantly illegal shit.
Yeah.
And they have the ability to do so. So can you just talk about some of the challenges that that presents, because they have an endless amount of resources?
Yeah, you know, I make sure I express that all the time, especially when I'm talking to a politician, or even talking to Marty Walsh, the Secretary of Labor, who I just was with last week. I'm telling them, like, hey, look, this company knows the NLRB process is weak. They knows the this country laws and labor is weak. They're breaking the law as we speak right now. Literally, I told Marty Walsh this. I'm saying, hey, I got an election going on in Albany. They're not even allowing the observer into observe the tent. You know what?
And this is the National Labor Relations Board observer.
This is our
union
observer.
Oh, okay.
So they don't even abide by any type of rules. They break the law, knowing that it takes months and years to get any type of remedy. On purpose, and that goes for Amazon, goes for Starbucks, goes for any of these industries that are organizing. And that is why our organizing efforts, we have to push these politicians to do their jobs. And not just push them to do their jobs, we got to call them out, hold them accountable. You know, people have seen me do that.
Yep.
And I'm going to continue to do so. And that's what other labor leaders and union presidents need to be doing, the same thing, not just myself.
Let's talk about the structural part, and then I want to get back to the politicians who are sort of like who have the apparatus. We had Jordan Flowers on in like May, I guess, and one thing he did cite was that, you know, something that people just don't think about outside. You know, if you're not organizing a union, you may not even contemplate the idea of like what's the difference that you can organize people on site versus not, which was a small change ostensibly that the National Labor Relations Board instituted when they were basically, you know, been appointed by Biden, or at least the majority in the general counsel. How much does a structural difference like that help? What are other, when you sit down and you go talk to Marty Walsh, in addition to like, you need to do something that is, that inhibits their behavior beyond a fine or a reinstatement that takes 7-10 months a year. You know, they've been able to do so much damage during that time that it's just the cost of doing business. Okay, fine. We rehire that dude. It doesn't matter because we've already gotten rid of the union. We pay this fine. We don't even spend that on lunch break. But aside from that, and then we can talk more about that. But aside from that, are there other structural things that you guys have figured out that don't seem like a big deal, but would, in the course of helping you organize these places, would be helpful?
So what we figured out is basically that not only can you get to an election, you know, it really don't take a lot of resources. You know, we didn't have any. And we were able to do it. And now, even though with the two losses, those are learning experiences. And, You know, we really are now studying how the company union busts, and that's going to help us with future campaigns. You know, knowing their strategy now, we've seen it repetitively, and knowing that, you know, we've been successful. It's just really about meeting the workers where they at, and learning about that specific community needs first. So, for example, we have a campaign in California, where I just came from, and they have a really good committee there. They have really good pro-union workers there. The company's already union busting. They're already putting them in captive audiences. But the cost of living, the issues are different, slightly different than JFK 8 in Staten Island. So I have to go, and I have to educate other members as well, have to go, and we have to learn about their specific demands. And once we do that, then we can assess how we're going to organize against the company. And what we learn now, you know, with every campaign, no matter what, there has to be an education phase prior to filing. You know, we can't file and then educate the workers, because by then, by the time we file, Amazon's already knee deep in union busting.
Right.
So we spend really with JFK 11 months, we spent the first 3 months really educating before we even start to get to the filing. We're doing that a lot faster with the campaigns now. We're starting to educate them right off the rip, and we're going to start having town hall meetings prior to filing, where we're going to bring on legal counsel from the union now, bring on members from the already unionized building of JFK, bring on myself, bring on politicians, possibly if they need to be, bring on different folks that can tell them what the difference is from being an ununionized worker to being a unionized worker. And they get to directly ask the questions that they want to ask when they're in these captive audiences, but they don't get the opportunity to, because it's only one side. It's only the company side. But now they're in a space where they feel comfortable. So that's what we've been learning that we need to do, is bring workers to spaces where they don't feel surveilled, they don't feel tracked, they feel comfortable. It's more personal, and they can ask the right questions and get the answers, the correct answers that they need, not the information from the company, but the information from union members and union representatives from different parts of the country.
How did the pandemic in general, I know it was instrumental to your organizing journey, but how has it affected other workers and their willingness to hear you out or hear other ALU people out? In your experience, what have you seen that the pandemic has created?
Well, the pandemic definitely put the world on a standstill. I think that was the reason why when I got fired, you know, my story made, you know, international news, because nobody was working.
Yeah.
You know, and on top of the fact that I was fired in New York City, you know, I'm pretty sure if I was fired in Alabama, y'all wouldn't be talking to me right now.
Right.
And also, if it wasn't the pandemic, y'all wouldn't be talking to me right now. And there wouldn't be no Amazon labor union. You know, so I just think the pandemic was a catalyst for advocacy for workers' rights. And it didn't matter whether you're unionizing or not. You know, we were out there on the picket line just because of COVID-19, but it intertwined into other work-related issues, and now we're talking about a union now. So it was a start. The pandemic was a start and the catalyst, but I think we're now at a point in this country where workers realize that, you know, our value is a lot more than what we've been getting, especially being deemed as an essential worker. You know, that means that we're a necessity. They need us, and they need to treat us as such and pay us as such.
I want to get back to the education that you guys do, and you've now sequenced it where you're not going to file until you feel like you have educated enough of the workers that as the management ratchets up their campaign to demonize the union, there's like a foundation, right, of understanding about what the union is. How much of that do you do – like surreptitiously? Like, how much do you, like, how is it even possible to go in and be like, we're going to get a month of educating maybe six, like, I mean, do you roll it out? And obviously I don't want you to say too much about, you know, like, we're doing this in Arizona, right? Now, but like, for people, because we get a lot of people who call in who are like, how do we go about doing this? And this idea of like, do you form like a cadre of like 4 people, 10 people, like, and then before you realize like, okay, now it's going to start getting public, but we have enough of a head start that we have an advantage because we've moved before they realize what's going on.
Right. So here we don't, I'm going to tell you as much as I can without telling what we're looking for. But, so when I go to a different building that's ready to organize, I don't do anything, to be honest with you, but support what's already in place. So, for example, Albany, they had their own committee. LGA5, Staten Island, across the street, even from JFK8, they had their own committee. ONCA in California, they had their own committee. And those workers decide when they want to file. I don't tell them when. I say, you guys are ready to file. You got the numbers. They say, yeah, we do. And we, without question, we support that because it's a 100% worker-led union, meaning that when the workers are ready to file, they are ready to file. And I don't think we need to change that strategy. You know, maybe because, you know, just because we lost the 2 campaigns doesn't mean that, you know, the workers shouldn't have filed. It just means that the efforts on the company side were so detrimental and just so illegal that workers didn't vote the right way. And it's not the workers' fault. We never blame the workers that vote no. We just know that they're misinformed. So I just think, you know, what we're looking for with these campaigns is really having a foundation of committee members that are ready to organize on their specific shifts. And when they're ready, we file right away. We're never going to be an advantage. You know, Amazon fires people every day. So for us to get to a 30%, it's impossible, nearly impossible. We're able to do it. But just to think that we're really going to have 30% by the time we get to an election, if we don't organize every single day, that number can reverse just like that. So we... After we file,
why 30%? What is that? I'm not sure I follow that. Like,
so 30% is what you need to file for.
Okay. 30% to sign off on basically, you know, right. It's not quite card check, but it's what would have been the idea that just we want an election. Okay,
so that's that. You need 30% of shown of interest. You know, so getting to that is a challenge. Even getting to 30%, because by the time you file and submit your cards, the NLRB does a card check with the payroll, meaning that if anybody's not on that payroll, the card pretty much doesn't count. And Amazon has access to the payroll. The union doesn't. So we can say there's 1,000 workers. The company's going to come back and inflate those numbers to try to say we don't have the 30%. That's why we've been forced to withdraw 2 times, because we believe that it's this amount of workers in the building, and they lie to the board, present a document that says, no, there's twice as many.
They get to self-report?
Pretty
there's
much.
No audit?
Do they include, what, contractors and things like that? Or
we don't know who the hell they got on that list. I saw information that said that they had, with JFK, I could talk about this because it's already happened, but basically... Their payroll, they had people on payroll that's been fired for over a year. So they kept them in their payroll system. And we phone banked these people. We called them. And these people told us that they haven't worked for the company in over a year, but yet they're still in the system as an active employee. So we don't know until we get the information. And because the board is not going to call 8,300 people.
Right, right.
That's what we're dealing with. And the same thing happens with the other campaigns. You know, Amazon inflates the numbers to make it seem like there's hot more workers in the buildings than it's not. So okay.
So I give you Marty Walsh's job, right? Tomorrow. Don't ask me how I managed to do this.
You're the president.
I'm the president of the United States. You have Marty Walsh's job. Like, what structure? Like, how do you fight that? Like, I mean, there's no way the National Labor Relations Board is going to have the staff at any point to go track down. Do you say, like, when you file this, you need to file with canceled checks for all these people? Or, like, is it reporting requirements? Like, how do you fight against that?
Well, I see that's what I want to figure out myself. That's why I went down there and scheduled this private meeting. But I want to understand his job as well.
Right.
And from my understanding, Congress sets this budget. And the budget is set. And, for example, they can't take money from the airline industry and put it into the NLRB.
Right.
They can't move money, even though Trump did it. But for some reason, they can't move money from one entity to another government entity. And I'm like, well, in the meanwhile, if you don't do anything, these corporations are going to get away with murder, which they have. So I think Marty Walsh right now, his best fight besides opening up OSHA investigations and, you know, showing up to different demonstrations and talking about unions and, you know, all of that stuff. The accountability aspect, you're the Secretary of Labor of the country. You need to get these CEOs into a room one by one or as a group, as a whole, and sit them down and let them know, not even let them know, tell them to negotiate with their workers. Other companies, other countries, I'm sorry, do this all the time.
Right.
Just left my office where I was talking to Norwegian Parliament, their council. They got way better laws. Laws that is national agreements, meaning that they only need 10% of any working industry to say they want a union. And after that 10% of the workforce say yes, that is it. They get that contract agreement. They sign off on it. The workers don't got to worry about nothing else. And they get a tax deductible for union dues at the end of the year. I just learned that 20 minutes ago. So it's like there's different things right across the border in Canada. They have something called a bargaining agreement where as soon as you win your election, that's it. Case closed. Company comes to the table. There is no appeal, go to the Supreme Court, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, five. There's none of that.
We have a lot of instances in this country where people get unionized and then they don't get a contract for years and years.
Exactly.
Because the corporation is able to sort of like drag their feet and make the, it harms other unions. It harms that union. It makes the union look ineffective because they're fighting against doing that contract. I mean, a lot of what you're talking about is the National Labor Relations Act, which was set up 80 years ago,
yeah.
90 years ago. I can't do the math at the moment, to essentially avoid things like wildcat strikes, avoid strikes across outside of, you know, within the context of industries, outside of shops. I mean, so much of the playing field was tilted towards corporations that on some level it's like it's always going to be an uphill battle until we get more like legislative support on some level.
Yeah. No, well, that's what we're up against as well. We're not just battling Amazon anymore. And I told that to my team even last year before we even voted. You know, we were battling Amazon. We were battling the landowners and global matrix. We're battling a global strategist, the union busting firm. We're battling the NYPD. So we're up against major bodies of companies, not just small companies and corporations. So our organizing efforts in this country, as far as the labor movement, we're the ones that have to push legislative. We're the ones that have to force these politicians to do their job. And a lot of established unions, unfortunately, and we all know, they endorse these politicians, they support these politicians, they do all of this stuff and don't get anything in return.
Right.
And, you know, I've obviously been calling them out, and that works. But it's not, it shouldn't just be the Amazon Labor Union and Starbucks Workers United. You know, we're talking about companies that have been around 28, 30 years. Where's the rest of these other union leaders at? It's time for them to take a stance and stop inviting these Democrats to their union conventions and endorsing them if they're not really living up to their campaign promises. And that's what it boils down to, accountability. And that starts with the unions. It starts with the politicians. And it starts with ourselves. You know, we gotta do this for ourselves. So, you know, hopefully our efforts with the ALU, getting to different spaces, myself traveling the country, inspiring and motivating people, that's what I'm trying to do. You know, wake everybody up saying, like, hey, if we don't organize within this window of opportunity, I'm talking about before 2024 is around the corner. And we don't do anything now, this window of opportunity is gone. It's going to be a point of no return.
I mean, part of that is we're already watching the Fed do their best to essentially diminish worker power. I mean, you know, we can talk about, I mean, they have a dual mandate, and supposedly it goes like this. And right now, they're basically, I mean, I don't even basically, they're literally saying we just need to raise unemployment. We need to disempower workers. And that's going to be, you know, that ends up being more of a challenge, I would imagine, in terms of unionizing, you know, where there's a sense of like we could lose our job and the economy is tight and this and that. And so it does feel like there is these windows arrive at specific times, and sometimes they must be taken advantage of. Card check was another one. There wasn't as much time, I think, as people remember, where you had 60 votes in the Senate under Obama. But like that should have just been done the moment Al Franken got to Washington in whatever it was, June or July of 2009. They should have just been like, this vote is on the floor. Boom, we're done. Let me ask you this. Do you think they follow you? Like, it just occurred to me as you're telling me, like, you're going to these different places. Like, if I was, I don't know if Jeff Bezos is really, I would imagine it's on his radar. But if I was one of these people, I would be like, we're just going to know where Chris is every single day. And if we had the ability to tap his phone or get a sense of like what his like, I want to know if he's talking to somebody in Arkansas. I want to know if he's talking to somebody in Memphis. Do you get the sense that they're watching you because they want to know where the next sort of warehouse they got to worry about is?
Oh yeah, they're definitely watching me. That's a guarantee. They know that I'm here. Anything that's
hey,
on,
guys.
You know, just say hey. You know, once this goes up, this goes right to their lawyers. No guarantee, 100%. They watch my Twitter, they watch my Instagram, they screen record every video that I post. They, you know, I've seen all of this in the trial. They use all our TikTok videos, our tweets against us, our text messages. They do all of that. They subpoena everything. So I honestly, for them following me, I guess they're going to get bored because all I'm doing is organizing. You know, I'm going from place to place and I'm talking about labor and I'm talking about unions and I'm talking about, you know, how we're going to defeat Amazon and different industries. And so I'm not afraid of the surveillance because I already know I can't escape it. I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't. So it's no need to be in secrecy or try to move, you know, like a, you know, I don't know, like a politician maybe. I don't do any of that. You know, I'm always in the streets. I'm always leading rallies. I'm always out front. You know, I'm a real fighter, you know, and I'm just an ordinary worker. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter what celebrity space they may have seen me on. That doesn't change who I am as a person. You know, I know a lot of people say this and that about me. They don't know me. You know, they never met me. They never been around me. The people that have been around me, organizing with me for the last few years, and the ones that I met along my journey, they know exactly what type of person I am. They know that I would never fall victim to, you know, just a bunch of BS. You know, I'm not going to fall for that. I'm going to do what's right for the workers at all times. I'm going to say what I need to say. I'm going to continue to be the voice for many of the Amazon workers, and I'm going to continue to help them reach platforms and share their stories. You know, that's what I'm about. And Amazon won't be able to stop that. They won't be able to stop what started. They won't be able to stop the culture that we created with the ALU. We're here forever. And I know Jeff Bezos has one of three thoughts a day, and I know one of them is us.
I mean, I would imagine, honestly, because this is, and I would say, and first off, let me just welcome the folks from Amazon here. And
hey,
if
Jeff.
You can, like,
what's up, Preston?
And also, you know, Poggers on Twitch, you can give us your subscriber. Yeah,
can Jeff Bezos super chat us, please?
Do you ever, like, take a lot of, like, different trips to different places and be like, oh, maybe we're doing it over here. Maybe we're
that's
doing
what
it
you
over
do,
there.
Sam.
That's what I would do. But,
all the time.
Change that noise signal ratio. Yeah, watch out for that, guys. Yeah. And I mean, I would imagine not only is this something that Bezos thinks about every day, but, you know, Howard Schultz has got to be pissed at you. Like, there's got to be. Because I think there is a feeling, and I think it's a legitimate one, that if this becomes, and all really, you know, all it takes is a couple more until it becomes a trend. And if this becomes a trend in the context of Amazon, where they have seemingly, you know, unlimited resources, in which, at least financial resources, in which to stop the workers from unionizing, I mean, you know, they're looking to go to Mars to spend some of the extra cash that they have. They've got to be worried that this is like, if we could do it at Amazon, we can do it anywhere.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Starbucks is, as far as their campaign, you know, they got over 250-something stores, and the numbers grow every day. I wish that we were able to that trend that fast, but warehouses, obviously thousands of workers are right. A little bit more strenuous and a little bit more into it. But it's not stopping. Like you mentioned, the fire has already been lit. It doesn't matter win or lose with these campaigns. The narrative and the motive is out there already. Workers are paying attention. Workers are now realizing that it's possible. You know, we did the impossible, and now it's possible, and people can see that. So billionaires just have to be worried, you know, and that's what our job as organizers is, to make sure that they're uncomfortable at all times. And I don't care whether it's Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, that now, you know, he owns Twitter, so you know we can't tweet no more because it ain't going to get seen by nobody but ourselves. And, you know, we have to be creative, and we got to create our own propaganda as well. And I just think we're doing a great job of doing that, because if we didn't, you know, they weren't worried about us.
Right.
And but, you know, with our TikTok videos and our Instagram and Facebook and whatever else that we're utilizing to amplify unions in this country, is definitely changing the tides. It's slow, but we're clawing our way back in a trend that is really pro-union in this country. I believe over 70% of Americans now believe that everybody should be in a union. And I think that's a large part of what has happened with Starbucks and Amazon, for sure.
Do you ever have you had any moments where you're dealing with some of these people that, like, I don't know if they're lawyers or they're union busters or they're working for the company? I mean, where they in some way sort of like have a moment where they have some measure of self-doubt. I mean, I can, like, when I have conversations with people who are anti-union, it is they are thinking about sort of like these big institutional unions that, and, you know, big institutions have some measure of corruption and you know, or they're not always working for the workers or whatever it is. I mean, these, you know, that happens in big institutions regardless of what it is. But I would imagine, like, if I'm sitting across the table from you, I'm a lawyer at Amazon or something, that it becomes hard for me to maintain that sort of demonization when it's like, these are just like people who worked at the factory. Like, this is not like all the things that I've been sort of trained to believe. I'm just looking at people who they have kids, they have families, they have medical bills. They're, you know, statistically speaking, like their longevity is going to be less than mine because I'm a lawyer. And, you know, if I'm working in a factory, just the numbers are there. You don't need to go very far to find it. Has there ever been a moment where, like, somebody across the hall, you know, across the table from you is going like, I'm sorry about this, man? Like, I would think that there's people out there who would at one point say, like, okay, I'm making a lot of cash, but really, what am I doing with my life?
Amazon lawyers, probably no. They are, it's just not good people. I don't know how else to cut it. They're not connected at all. They just have no emotional connection to anything but their job. You know, and it's like, that's what Amazon wants. You know, they pay these lawyers, you know, $10,000 an hour or something. Like, I don't know what they pay them. Right. They're millionaires. So Amazon tried to use the black and brown card. They had a black and brown lawyer, women of color, to represent, you know, them. And I remember meeting her for the first time when I had to walk in there and shake her hand. And she didn't even shake my hand. She's like, COVID. I'm like, COVID? I'm like, damn, okay. So,
were you guys in masks?
Yeah, we were masked up, and
COVID also not so much transmittable by the handshake.
I was, yeah.
People, I mean, I can appreciate
that. I was like, okay, COVID. I'm like, you done been in this warehouse. This is the mecca of COVID right here.
Right.
You've been in JFK. You got COVID already. So you shaking my hand at the tent where they're about to vote prior to voting. Okay, whatever. You don't shake my hand. And this is the woman of color, you know, Amber. And when we won, it was my turn, you know. So I went back, and then when we won at the NLRB office on April 1st, she reached her hand out to shake my hand. And I was like, COVID.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I could play the game too. And with their lawyers, they saw, you know, we saw the evidence. It's racist. They called us thugs. One woman said that she's scared that I'm going to come to her house because I have her information. I'm going to do this and that. I'm a gangbanger. I'm this, that, and the third. This woman never met me in her life. Actually, she did, because she was an observer at the tent. And I came in that day with my kids. You know, so I'm like, wow, I'm a human. I'm a father. Never been arrested. Don't have no criminal record. How could you just come up with all these things? And these lawyers know that. They know. They have to look me up too. They got to do their homework.
Right.
They know exactly. I was a model employee for Amazon. Model. I had to be. You don't last 5 years at Amazon if you're not a good employee. I don't give a damn what you're doing.
Right. They have spreadsheets on every single person. They know exactly what your productivity is and how many bathroom breaks you take. And
right. So beyond model employee, I opened up three buildings, not just one. JFK was my last building. Opened up two other prior. And I mean, opened them up. I was there on day one. I was one of the first employees there. I trained the general manager that was there, no longer there because we won. But the general manager that was there during our campaign, even prior to that, I trained 4 years ago in my New Jersey warehouse. So my, you know, just my ins and outs with the company, my tenure with the company alone to speak for itself.
What did they ultimately fire you for?
The walkout.
Just just because you got sick of the way. So, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that was it. You know, one time out of 5 years, I speak up and I get fired when I've done all these great things for that company. They had no idea who I was. They had no idea the amount of blood, sweat, and tears I poured into the company. I was invested. And that's the difference with these campaigns, is that the organizers in JFK are invested with Amazon. They've been there. This is their main source of income. They've been with the company for years. The other campaigns, the workers are not there yet. The organizers are not there yet. They're not quite there yet. They're going to get there. We're fast tracking them there, but it takes years. It takes a peak season, which is a holiday season. It takes a couple of those for you to survive and be like, all right, I know Amazon. I know my coworkers. Now I'm ready to talk about unionizing. You know, you can't just throw salts in the building. You can't just, you know, stay outside the building like I did. And it's not going to work like that anymore. We have to be creative, but you also got to have lead organizers who are invested in the company.
Do you think that they underestimated you?
Absolutely.
Because of, like, well, one, they underestimated your investment in the company, and two, there also weren't there statements that they made where, like, that were along the lines of what you described, where they just basically didn't think that you would be able to organize your workplace like this, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the company underestimated us at first, but then they realized, like, okay, you know, we're getting somewhere. We kept filing, and we had to withdraw at one time, and then we resubmitted. So the momentum was always there. They just didn't know how to stop it. They had no idea how to stop us. I'm like, all right, this guy's at the bus stop. We called the cops on them about 20 times. The cops didn't know what to do until they arrested me, and that turned a lot of workers towards us as well. So I just think, you know, the creativity and doing things that the company can't do, it's a major factor into how you beat these corporations. You know, you don't beat Amazon by, you know, just having conversations and handing out a pamphlet and having a classroom. We're talking about, you know, 8,000 people from all different walks of life. So we had to be cultural. We had to be inclusive. We had to make sure we ain't, you know, show that we're siding too much with the Democrats and Republicans. We had to be neutral on a lot of issues, but we always redirected towards the work-related issues at Amazon. You know, what happens on the work floor that anybody can agree with needs to be changed. And that's how we were ultimately able to get people on board.
And you guys have a fundamental understanding of that in a way that none of the Amazon management or lawyers can ever understand.
Never.
The thing about the investment in the company is interesting, because I wonder, like, just talk about that a little bit more, because it sounds like you had pride, not, I mean, in the work that you had been doing for Amazon, like the idea that, like, you were the guy that, you know, and I would imagine there's thousands who, you know, who also are this, but that's still a fraction. You know, it feels good to be working at a place and know, like, oh, I'm the first employees they're going to put in a new place, because it's validation of how hard I've worked and that I'm smart about my job. And like that sort of paradox on some level was like where it seems to me that, like, the most dedicated workers are going to be the ones who first, like, come to the conclusion of, like, wait a second, none of what of the effort that I have put in is being respected in any way.
Yeah.
By any type of return.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to toot my own horn. I don't want to do that. But I'm just going to say it like this. You see how popular we are now, and myself and the labor movement. And you see how I dress. I've been like this my entire life. People don't know that. So when I walked in the Amazon building, no matter with New Jersey, Connecticut, Staten Island, I was the most popular person in the building. hands down. So I really was the general manager because the management came to me because they didn't know their job. I had to train them. And the workers came to me because I was their supervisor. And the higher-ups respected me because they knew I knew what I was doing. They ain't had to worry about nothing. I was doing their job. So even as a hourly associate, I was doing jobs for people that make over $100,000 for years. So my investment and my popularity, even within the company, they had no idea. I was the most popular person in JFK, the most popular person in New Jersey, the most popular person in Connecticut. And I only worked one shift, but everybody in the building know me because they see me every day. They see me 40, 50, 60 hours a week. They saw me before work, after work. I'm such a people's person. I hang out all day and night. I used to hang out with my coworkers. I used to hang out with workers in my department. Even though it's frowned upon, they're like, oh, management can't hang out with their employees. I'm like, why? They're people. They're cool as hell. I'm hanging out with them. I'm going bowling. Yeah. I'm going to their kids' birthday parties. I've been to a lot of birthdays and family events for workers just because they invited me. I show up, vice versa. So the relationships and the investment that I had with Amazon is just completely different. You would never see another process assistant, which is a PA for Amazon, like me, because it's never been one. And till this day, you think about it, where are the other process assistants that are there now, are been there during the pandemic? Where are they? They're still working. They're still invested. Hopefully, you know. I didn't have that. I didn't have selfishness where I only cared about my own personal career growth. I always cared about the entry level workers because that's where I came from and the people around me. So when COVID-19 came into play, it was really easy for me to take a stance. It's a no-brainer. It's a life or death situation. The company dropped the ball. They didn't give us masks. We're being called heroes. And I got workers passing out, vomiting, not coming up to work every day. So as a supervisor, being a person of leadership, being responsible for 600 other people in my department in a building that at the time had 5,000 workers, how could I not speak up and say anything? And that's where I, you know, took my stance. Is I couldn't stand with it anymore. I said, this is life or death. This is not just a one time, oh, you know, COVID's going to come here. We was watching CNN every day in the break room, sitting shoulder to shoulder when they're telling us to be 6 feet apart.
Right.
And Seattle was the epic center before New York City. People forgot that the senior citizen home in Seattle.
Yep.
So they were dying. So I'm like, okay, before it comes to New York City, but it was already too late. It was already here. Before it comes to this warehouse, what are we going to do? So instead, they respond by firing me. And that's when I knew that I couldn't allow this company to get away with that.
Well, and the story continues. Hopefully, as you go around the country, and he's going all around the country, Amazon lawyers, you find more Chris Smalls at different factories who can help with this. Really appreciate you coming in. Real pleasure. And, you know, you obviously been an inspiration for, I don't know, people across in various levels. I mean, we've had people call in, tell us that they're organizing a Starbucks or they're, you know, Trader Joe's. And it's all because they saw what you guys were able to do in Staten Island. And so really appreciate the work you're doing. And
thank you.
And good luck with it. And, you know, hopefully we'll have you back in again.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so let me one final thing. What can folks who don't work at Amazon, maybe aren't in a union or what, like, how can people in a community where you're starting to organize
How can they help?
Oh, yeah. Well, we always have different demonstrations where we want people to show up and amplify it. You know, the workers that are organizing these warehouses, they come from your community. They're your neighbors. They're your family members. You know, one out of every four Americans is going to work for Amazon in the next couple of years.
Well,
or have worked. Are going to know somebody who worked there. So this is really everybody's fight. You know, everybody was mad about, you know, me going to the White House, shaking Joe Biden's hand and this, that, and the third. Then he gets $10 billion to Amazon. What are you mad at me for? Be mad at him.
Right.
That's your tax dollars, too. I've been out of a job for 2.5 years. I've been paying no taxes. So I have been with the union, though. Correction.
Right.
Yeah.
Union's been paying tax. But, you know, I'm just saying, tax dollars, the $10 billion that's been given to the corporation, then Jeff Bezos to go to space, that is our money, everybody in the community money. So how can they get involved? They're already involved. Amazon is surveilling them, too. You got a Ring camera. You got Amazon Prime. You got any of its, you know, many companies that they own. They own 75 or 78. You're a part of Amazon already in some capacity. It's your fight, too. So show up, post our GoFundMe, not GoFundMe, I'm sorry, donation link. We do have a strike fund out there, a solidarity fund. Share anything that you see online, stories that you hear about from these, you know, workers, amplifying that. Anything, cancel your Prime. You know, that's a help and stand in solidarity with the workers until, you know, the company does better. We're not saying that we want to shut down Amazon and, no, we're saying that the company needs to do better. They have the resources. They have the money. They need to pay their workers. They need to take care of their employees. And they need to recognize the union.
They have unlimited funds to pay for lawyers, to
watch
fight,
us.
To fight you guys and disrespect you guys and watch you guys. Right. So, I mean, that's the key.
And let me just say, in defense of the Amazon lawyers who have no feelings for other people, I will just say that, like, in my experience, this is just a lawyer trait. So it's not just that there were, I mean, I,
yep.
I've, this is something over the years that I've noticed with lawyers. They are lawyers first and then humans second often. Sometimes you can let a little bit of humanity seep in.
Exactly.
In these instances.
Right.
All right. Chris Smalls, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back and do a little bit of fun half stuff. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It's a freebie Monday. God.
Wow.
God.
So, and we can
Chris Mull's four-star hand on that.
Yeah. Right? Yep. But it's Halloween, power. So we can have a little bit of fun in the.
Now, look.
Freaky Friday.
There's a couple of things. First off, we'll take this opportunity to say thank you to Chris, who sent us a bunch of beef jerky. I love it. And it's good, too, because it's.
Not Chris Smalls.
No. Different Chris. Oh, yeah. Okay. No.
Not only does he have great fashion sense, he comes with dried meats.
Provisions.
Chris sent us some beef jerky. And it's also, not only is it beef jerky, which I happen to love, there's very little sugar in it, which is hard to find, like, beef jerky where they don't put sugar in it. And some of it has no sugar. Thank you for that. Also, I was reminded of that because it's Halloween. On Friday, I made the mistake of saying, or the other day, like, hey, we're not going to do a Halloween thing. Mm. And then, of course, everybody assumes immediately after I say that I'm going to do a Halloween thing. And not. We had Chris in. We didn't have time to do it.
It's spooky for Jeff Bezos.
It's spooky. Yeah, we just scared the hell out of Jeff Bezos. Letter Hack. This inspired Letter Hack to draw what, as far as I could tell, was an endless stream of horror movie parodies.
Wow.
And so check out Letter Hack. We'll put a link to his Twitter feed. And you'll see all these images. I mean, it was really exceptional. And I kept, like...
I must have missed this.
There's a bunch. There's, like, this one. There's other ones that are scary. This is sort of cute.
Yeah.
This is, like...
Aww.
Yeah? Look at that. Look at that. Also, what we're going to do is we're going to re-release as a separate video. Because I don't think we've ever done it as a separate video, have we? I don't think so.
Yeah, I think we just clipped it and like played it at the end.
The 2018 Halloween show we did, which features Michael front and center as a way of like both like providing something for Halloween that's funny, but also, you know, this is a day that Michael would be very, very happy about. And so we'll show you. He does it pretty funny.
It's funny, the impressions that we do, like, one of them is still current, but, like, the whole sort of vibe that we are satirizing definitely exists and more developed today, but, like, the figures kind of fall
yes.
off.
Yeah. It's really amazing. But the trajectory is there. Yeah. In fact, I'm not going to say who, but somebody sent me a text with an image of Jimmy Dore talking about something. I don't know. It was funny. And Jimmy's wearing like this, one of his goofy hats so that you know he's a comedian. And he goes, you gotta buy a hat like this, dude. It's just too funny. And I was like, oh, wait a second. I got to show him a screenshot of Michael's impression. And there's the
and it's the same hat.
Well, not the exact same hat, but a goofy hat. It's right there, actually.
Oh, right. Yeah. Like, right.
Oh, I mean, I could see wearing a hat. Like people wear hats, but I don't know. It's weird for me to wear a hat. Like
doing the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why would I wear a hat?
Well,
I'm trying
to
make a point.
Yeah. Right. Right.
A generic hat. Like I can see wearing a baseball hat.
Some men. Yeah. It's like if they don't have as much hair.
Team.
Right. Yeah. Well,
I guess. I don't know.
Okay.
All right. Where's my sound sheet? Here it is. Let's read some IMs, shall we?
Sure.
Please, finally clip and re-release the Jimmy doorknob call. It's a Halloween spook. Oh, yeah. No, we got to do that, too. Will you remind me of that?
I don't remember that one.
No, they're talking about the debate. That from 2016, we got to get on that.
I think you should do like Sam's stream.
Oh yeah,
some night.
That's exactly what I should do, and now I know how to do it.
Yep,
do a Sam reaction to the
Sam
and Jimmy debate. Yep.
That's like the business model now.
Yeah, exactly.
Then I could do a reaction to my reaction stream of the original.
The third reaction to the reaction will probably get the most.
I would comment differently. If I could comment today, I'd comment differently on the debate that I'm commenting on.
Exactly. Iowa Ryan, today one of my bosses said Musk is his favorite African American. Oh, God.
That's maybe the worst thing about this whole Elon thing is the lame ass jokes.
Yeah.
Like let that sink in.
That
like
was DeSantis classic. That.
Did you see that he dissolved the board of Twitter and now he's the sole head?
Yeah, I mean, he's going to find out that there are liability problems with getting rid of some of that cover your ass stuff.
But, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, this is going to be...
If Tesla's any indication of how he skirts regulations.
I mean, this is going to be honestly fascinating because I think one of two things are going to happen. One is everything goes back to the way it was and he just keeps spouting off a little bit, but really in reality, nothing changes. The other is that this, you know, just degrades in the way that like MySpace did or Friendster or whatever. I mean, you know, Twitter wasn't going to last forever. And
then what has this all been for?
Well, it's for us to watch and laugh about.
Yes.
I mean, that's basically I think from his perspective, this is an unmitigated disaster.
No, I'm just...
And there's only so much like Adderall or whatever it is that you can take that will make you not realize that or avoid that that reality. But at one point, I think he's just going to be... I mean, it may have already existed. Like where, you know, he wakes up in the middle of the night and just looks into the mirror and says, what have you done?
Yes.
Why did you do this?
To be a troll. I mean, maybe I should just stop tweeting. It's meaningless now.
But that guy, it's David Sachs in the room with him now, apparently doing this stuff.
Oh. I mean,
yeah, things are going to get uglier. Steve from the Beach, great open. Between the 101 and the 5, Caruso is not just buying the election for himself. He's also getting his message out for every election happening in L.A. for candidates to share his message. It's like the biggest independent expector in L.A. So many other candidates are aligning with his message. The good news is that the left has laid down a good foundation from Bernie 2020 through many other elections that have been built on that. But it's just a strategy to note billionaires don't just buy elections for themselves. They have the funding to spread ideology up and down the ballot. Yeah, hopefully that doesn't work. But fierce deity, more like the Bolsonaro virus. Am I right? Nice. Celery Man, happy Halloween, Sam. I see you're wearing the same costume I am this year, a Harry Potter goblin. The classics never go out of style. Shalom. Am I wearing a Harry?
That is a rather a long way to go for a joke about how the goblins in Harry Potter are sort of anti-Semitic caricatures of Jewish folks.
Oh, I got you. Oh. What is the reaction I should have?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
I mean, I'm not 100% sure I know what the reaction is. I should be having that, but I assume it was said in the best of intention.
Yeah, it's an Elon fan.
Wargroads, a ship has already slipped the Russian net containing a lot of grain, so the bluff has already been called. 12 ships have already left Ukraine carrying 40,000 tons of grain bound for Ethiopia. Russian resolve is already being put to the test after what happened to the Moskva. Back in April, it's questionable how capable Russia's Black Sea Fleet is of enforcing a blockade. Well, didn't they also just... Didn't Russia... Russia's launching these attacks now as supposedly retribution for some other attack in the Black Sea. I didn't quite get what that initial attack was supposed to be. And, of course, I think Russia's agenda is let's knock out as many civilian services as possible because winter's coming and we want to exact as much pain as possible on the Ukrainian people. I mean, that seems to be the strategy. I mean, really, good time for the United States to go in and rebuild some of this infrastructure. I don't know then if you are complicating things by having
explicit U.S. personnel on the ground that may be
like Putin bombable. Giving an inch, take a mile. I don't know.
Yeah. Transistor. Wait, Twitter investment benefits aren't immediately vested. Guess I won't apply after all. Star Fox. New leftist alert. Can the Discord get a shofar for our brother Wu-Tang Financial in the Discord? He and his wife welcomed a second-generation MR fan to the fold yesterday. His wife and in-laws are Brazilian, so it was a joyous day all around. Left his best, and Wu-Tang forever. Congratulations. Sam, I'm calling in today to hopefully to get to discuss the trial against HCSO and the wrongful death of Andrew Joseph III. Please pick up number 813. We're not going to get to calls today, but we'll do it tomorrow. The fan from Toronto, thanks for the Michael cold open. Was thinking about him a lot yesterday and how he would have loved this moment. Wishing you guys all the best today. Ray, this was Michael's last studio show. It was March 2020.
Wow.
Holy shit. Did not realize that. No, the phones are not on.
Yeah, because looking back on it, that was the moment where Bolsonaro met with Trump and members of his delegation got COVID, but Bolsonaro himself didn't get COVID.
That must have been from March.
Like 7th, maybe? 10th. Or March 10th? Yeah, exactly. God.
Would be my bet.
When were the Nevada caucuses?
11th. Wait a second. March 13th with the Friday, I believe. So that would have been March 12th. That's my guess. El Conniption. I was listening at the time, and I remember that was one of your last days in the office. Please don't time me out on the IMs already. Talking about the Michael and Jamie clip. I don't know what that means, time me out on the IMs.
I don't think that's a thing.
No, it isn't a thing.
Yeah.
People all think that, like, don't shadow ban me from the IMs. Like, no, you just don't understand.
Soft block.
I've got an Adium thing up there. There's two ways in which we look at the IMs. One is on a screen, but if you refresh it, they all go away. And they move so quickly that you can't read one. So I use Adium, but I don't know what you're saying. Like, there's no preview. I just click on the thing. Nolan from the Detroit suburbs. Seeing that clip of Michael made me remember his impressions were what made me tune into you all in 2019 before the primary started for the 2020 election. Before then, I was just listening to John Oliver on YouTube once a week. I remember a caller back then saying Bernie is evil for supporting Medicare for all. The Michael goes into a Bernie Sanders impression saying how bad it is that he wants to provide health care to people at a cheaper cost than private insurance.
I'm so naughty. I'm doing it because it's bad.
Can we get two shofars, one for the Letter Hacks Trove MR-based Halloween art, which is mint, and one for Michael and his hopes of Lulu returning to office coming true? All right, we'll just do one in general. There you go. That's for Michael. Fippy, my wife and I bought our first home in Salem, Mass. Moved in this weekend. We received our grant to help our down payment and closing costs from this first-time homeowners program called Mass Dreams. If you're looking to buy a Mass, look into the program. Can we get a shofar? All right. Getting a lot of shofars today, but that's good. Congratulations. Dan from Missouri, to be fair to Bolsonaro, if I had been president for the last several years, the first thing I would want to do is take a nap and not talk to people. Yeah, fair enough. What should we not miss here?
I am playing
the Obama.
The Obama or... on Social Security clip.
Okay, yeah. Let's play. Look. Let's not comment on this first, because we got a couple of things to say about this. But understand that Democrats came to this a little bit late. But the leaders in the Republican Party, both in the House and in the Senate, have talked about their plan to use the debt ceiling, which is coming up, I don't know, maybe in December, is it? Maybe, or use the debt ceiling as a way to insist that we cut Social Security and Medicare in the form of the age in which you're eligible to get it. And maybe also just some other back-end cuts on cost of living increases, which is a cut. right? I mean, you're working all your life. You anticipate that you can retire early, get a little bit less of a payout at age 62, let's say, or maybe you're going to wait until 65, you get your full payout. Maybe you're going to wait till you're 67, get a little bump on it. Whatever it is, they want to push those ages higher, and it's a cut. And this is something they can do with Joe Biden in office, because the debt ceiling would be catastrophic if it is not raised, because we've already spent the money.
And in fact, they would prefer to do it with Joe Biden in office, frankly, because then if it was a Republican president, they wouldn't have to own it.
100%. Yes, great point. And here is Barack Obama. Finally, somebody's out there talking about it. Sound.
You don't need a tax break. But no, he fought for this. And then his adult children bought not one, not two, but three private planes. Because apparently carpooling was not an option.
Oh, pause it. He's talking about Ron Johnson here. We should be clear. And this is good. This is important. They need to get that vote out in Wisconsin.
A plane, you don't need a tax break. But no, he fought for this. And then his adult children bought not one, not two, but three private planes, because apparently carpooling was not an option. Now, I mean,
to be honest, it is more convenient to have three than one.
Meanwhile, Senator Johnson voted to raise the retirement age to 70, supported a plan that would put Social Security and Medicare on the chopping block every single year. Each year you'd have to vote to renew this thing. I mean, think about it, because Washington works so well. That's, you want your Social Security and Medicare reliant on Congress every year. He's called Social Security a Ponzi scheme. Said that it's candy that the left is giving away. The point is, some of you here are on Social Security. Some of your parents are on Social Security. Some of your grandparents are on Social Security. You know why they have Social Security? Because they worked for it. They worked hard jobs for it. They have chapped hands for it. They had long hours and sore backs and bad knees to get that Social Security. And if Ron Johnson does not understand that, if he understands giving tax breaks for private planes more than he understands making sure that seniors who've worked all their lives are able to retire with dignity and respect, he's not the person who's thinking about you and knows you and sees you, and he should not be your senator from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I mean, right?
That was my reaction when I saw it, like, maybe yesterday. Was, whoa, right. Just a jarring reminder that, oh, he's that generational of a communicator.
I mean, I don't even remember him talking that way when he was president. I don't remember him.
Well, only on the campaign trail. When he gets into office, then he's, you know, circumspect.
Yeah. I mean, I never saw him that intense. I don't even feel like I saw him that intense on the campaign trail. Now, I'm going to be one little picky thing, and then we'll talk about but I don't like the idea of, like, government doesn't work. The reason why you don't want Social Security and Medicare to be considered discretionary spending and come up every time is because the Republicans have had a 90-year history, I mean, 86-year history of trying to destroy Social Security. Like, literally 86 years. The moment that it passed, they said it was socialism, and they attacked it. So the reason why you don't want it to come up to a vote every year is because you don't want Social Security to rely on the Republican Party not wanting to cut it on any given year. that's my little picky thing about what he said. He could have said that instead of saying, like, do you trust government to work? No, don't say that. But the other thing is, from day one,
mm-hmm.
in the Obama administration, and if you listen to this program, starting in, the day that it started, probably, we're talking about Barack Obama's explicit desire for what he called at that time entitlement reform prior to even being, when he was still a president-elect, he was talking entitlement reform. And in 2010, following the disastrous election, let's just also say, like, don't get too excited about him going around campaigning, because Democrats lost 1,000 seats across the country when this guy was out there saying, you know, trust me, I got this. I'm happy he's there. That's great. But don't get too excited about it in terms of, like, the implications of it. But his administration put on the table cuts to Social Security cost of living increases, which is another way of saying cuts to Social Security benefits, as part of his, like, pivot to austerity. And in fact, Joe Biden went around Harry Reid in the Senate to try and negotiate with Mitch McConnell. Now, fortunately, the Republicans have become so extreme and so determined not to give Barack Obama a win that they wouldn't even accept the cuts to Social Security in their grand bargain. And so by 2014, the Democratic Senate had voted a non-binding resolution to raise Social Security benefits, not cut them. And we dodged a bullet there. But don't let yourself forget.
Yes.
That, you know,
his passionate defense of Social Security should have been directed at himself literally 12 years ago when he was floating this. And it was the credit to activists and some of what I remember the first of seeing of, like, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who were criticizing this publicly. But it almost happened because of Obama's, yes, pivot to austerity, but also his seemingly insatiable desire to work with Mitch McConnell. And there was just no understanding yet about how to fight back against that. And we're lucky that we're at a point now where Obama can get fired up on the stump and defend Social Security, because that was not the political environment that it was 12 years ago.
Now, while we're in the picky mood, too, and I will say this, too, Illuminati kids, I am, good old Obama subtly rhetorically reinforcing the idea in a folksy way that you need to earn Social Security safety net programs rather than being deserved by everybody. This whole thing of, like, it's mine because I put into it and I've sacrificed my knees. And on some level, that's true. On some level, that's true. But the reason why we have Social Security in this country is because it keeps 2/3 of our elderly out of poverty. And the reason why we have Social Security in this country is because it's an insurance program. So even if your knees didn't go out or whatever it is, even if you were a wealthy person your whole life and you lost all that money because of, I don't know, some, email scam or you invested everything in Twitter or Tesla, and all of a sudden, one day, it turns out that this is all mirage. Regardless of it, the argument should be everyone deserves at the very least, a bare minimum, like being able to live their life in dignity after they're done with work. As a bare minimum, that's what everyone deserves. Regardless of whether you worked with your hands or hurt your knees or what, regardless, everyone deserves that as a society. That's why we should have a society.
Yeah.
It's one of those things, like, we should have a society because that way everybody's insured. One of the reasons everybody's insured that they will have some form of dignity when they retire.
But the thing is, and you're nitpicking, and it's not nitpicking, it's just, like, necessary context. Putting that aside to just speak positively about it for a second, or it's not even positive, but it just, it contrasts how we have yet to have a political communicator on the Democratic side of the aisle who even comes close.
Yeah.
I mean, Biden struggles to communicate regularly, and even the people who want to be him, like Pete Buttigieg, who's clearly just mimicking his every mannerism. The Democrats need to get some new blood in there to make people connect with, I don't know, what they're trying to sell to people, because it's just, Biden's not cutting it right now, and Kamala Harris is not going to cut it.
No, I mean, I think, listen, a good candidate, you always want a good candidate. I mean, that's, yes. Dank Uger says, I agree with Sam. That was the most fired up I've seen him since 2008. He must really not like Ron Johnson. You know what? I mean, let me say this. Is there anybody less likable in the Senate than Ron Johnson? Mm.
This guy couldn't even get through a what do you like about your candidate question without being an asshole.
Oh, he's just the worst.
I literally couldn't get through it without a backhanded, like, he still wants to destroy America.
Tommy Tuberville is stupid. But at least he did something on his own, yeah, right? He was a good football coach, I guess. Well,
you can coach kids who don't get paid anything, and you get to recruit with all the money. Actually,
that's the thing.
He didn't do anything. Being a college football coach is, you're one of the most depraved people in America. No offense, but whatever.
All right.
No, because they don't.
But
they
can recruit. That's a skill.
Yeah, you can suck up to kids and say, "Yeah, you're the man. Come play with me, and I won't pay you anything." And then if you don't perform, you tear your ACL, you're never getting paid ever again. And I'm going to fight for that system to remain in place. So no, actually, screw Tommy Tuberville. Ron Johnson's done more than Tommy Tuberville.
Matthew of Philadelphia. Oral argument before the Third Circuit next Tuesday in what may be rideshare drivers' last stand in avoiding forced arbitration under the FAA. Singh versus Uber. Singh represented by yours truly. Oh, excellent. Gibson Dunn of Chevron Donzinger fame for Uber. What exactly did railroad FAA Section 1 mean as of 1925? And does seamen cover all sailors or just the unlucky ones? You son of a bitch. I can't tell if that whole thing wasn't a joke. But Bradley, will you look that up? Third Circuit, Tuesday, Singh, Singh versus Uber. And just send me a link to that. Good. Train Boy. Sam is dressed like a Harry Potter goblin? I thought he was dressed like George Soros. I think the height increase in the population happened in Bolivia under Evo, not Brazil under Lula.
I'm pretty sure Bolsa Familia caused a height increase, but maybe I'm wrong about that. But I would double check that because I think that was a Lula thing.
That said, Lula did eliminate childhood poverty in Brazil during his presidency. Lefty archaeologist, thank you, Michael, today. How wonderful it would have been to share his joy about Lula's victory. And cap face slap. They'll get away with cutting Social Security by stopping collection first. Keep benefits rolling for a little while and frame it as more money in your pocket today. Middle school litter box bidet. I think the height thing is being misattributed to Lula. Pretty sure it was Evo Morales in Bolivia.
I'll have to recheck.
Fake news, Matt. Vermont Ben, I'm curious about the first guest opinion on Vermont Proposition 22, which enshrines reproductive rights into the Vermont Constitution in the post-Roe era. If that's what it does, I think that's a pretty good idea. But love and peace. You guys are on point. First thing I thought of when I saw that Lula won, Michael would have been dancing right now. Thank you for that one. Big Dippin. Sam, I can't believe you missed the perfect opportunity to say broadcasting undead steps from yada yada. Oh, yeah, that would have been good.
Right there. Oh.
Yeah. We are broadcasting undead steps from the...
I mean,
not so much.
I don't know if it's the perfect opportunity for... for whatever that is.
This is sort of interesting. I don't know who needs to hear this, but being Jewish is not synonymous with being Israeli. You can be Jewish, you can be supportive of the existence of Israel, you can have an attachment to Israel on a religious basis.
but not necessarily with the government. They're distinctive things. I do know who needs to hear this. It is Doug Mastriano and his wife. Christian Zionists support Israel because they believe all the Jews have to return there before the second coming. And then, of course, two-thirds of us Jews go into eternal hellfire. One-third of us get to sit next on the right-hand side of God.
Fingers crossed, Sam. I hope you make it, man.
Well, I've made this point before, and I hope someone's listening. I have eczema. Hellfire is one of the worst things for eczema.
The heat and the dryness?
That's when I get it. And it's environmental for me. And I would imagine the stress.
Yeah.
So I just right-hand side.
Please.
That's all I ask.
Come on, do him a solid.
Meanwhile, here is Doug Mastriano outsourcing his anti-Semitism to his wife.
Your rival's Jewish school and previous associations you had with Gab, the social network.
Yeah, so...
Oh, pause it, pause it. So he's saying, happens to be an Israeli cameraman or reporter saying, hey, can you address anti-Semitism? Because you have a very close relationship with the guy from Gab, which is basically like, I don't know, it's almost like a delivery service for anti-Semitism. It's like you would call up and I would like an order of anti-Semitism. Gab would be the service that would, yeah, it's like the DoorDash for anti-Semitism.
And he's also alluding to an ad that the Mastriano campaign ran where they referred to the private school, the Jewish private school that Shapiro's children go to as like an elite private school.
Right.
Like, yes. Pretty, you know, harsh undertones.
Yes.
Social network. Yeah, so.
I would like to make a comment
please.
On that real quick.
Oh, please, step in.
I'm just going to say as a family, we so much love Israel. In fact, I'm going to say we probably love Israel more than a lot of Jews do. I have to say that because, and the reason why I say that is because I've given, and Doug, we've given for, I would say, at least 10 years to outreach to Israel and Jerusalem. I have visited Israel, we say, for 5 years. We're just an average family. We're not wealthy, wealthy people.
Okay, so, I mean, just recap here. What of these charges of anti-Semitism where you seemingly use hatred of Jews as a way of campaigning? Doug, can I handle this?
Mm.
We're better than Jews insofar as we love Israel more.
Yeah.
So, I mean, hello.
Game, set, match.
I think that explains why we might be using anti-Semitism to get elected.
Yeah. It is, you can't really ever delineate or figure out which part about Israel they love more, which is the weird evangelical Christian Zionist element, but also the loving Israel as a vehicle to hating Muslim people is also, I just
the
think.
The beauty is.
That, right, it's a twofer.
You don't have to decide, Emma. That's what makes it so special.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, it's rare in life when you get things that are so multifaceted and helpful in every way. It's a win-win is what they call it.
Can you imagine like what Doug Mastriano and his wife are saying when they get home from this and they see the news coverage? They're like, first off, sweetheart, I thought you were wonderful. Mm. If it wasn't for the Jews twisting your words,
yeah,
it would have been a perfect answer.
Of course, I mean, they're going to cover it like this, like, you know, red media. Did you see that chart that Kanye West held up where it was like all the media that he says was owned by Jewish people and he included Walt Disney in it? I did a bit of a deep dive into this, but it's just, you know, kind of a wide net that they're casting for who they consider to be Jewish.
Walt Disneyberg?
Apparently. Yeah, him. Oh. Did you say that out loud?
Sorry?
That was supposed to be...
Oh, shoot. I'm not supposed to reveal
now
that.
You're in the two-thirds in hell.
We heard about that at the meeting, and they didn't want us to... shoot. Mm. You know, speaking of some anti-Semitism, you know, there's a sign on the BQE that says that someone put up a billboard like complaining about it's been 75 years since the gas chambers, complaining about anti-Semitism doesn't seem terribly like an overreaction or something like that. I mean, it was well stated. I grew up with a decent amount of it in Worcester. Like, you know, occasionally you've been playing basketball with somebody and you shoot a basket and you hear like a little Jew thing or something, or people throwing pennies. So I'm not like hugely sensitive to it in the same way. Like it was something like that was there and you got to deal with it. This shit is a little bit more disturbing in my mind because it involves more resources. It's not just some ding-dong on the playground. It is premeditated, and it, for people who see it, it makes them believe that it is okay. And this wasn't just at this place, but play this clip. This is down, this is a building in Jacksonville. And they were all over Jacksonville, I guess, around like the football game.
Also the Florida, yeah, right.
It was the University of Florida football game. There was a building before this. This was after the game, but this is the second line of text that was going around.
Yeah, I've seen this multiple times in different places around there. It's a sign on the side of a building that is like an electronic sign that puts up different sayings. Kanye is right about the Jews. I mean, who owns that building?
Yeah. And I mean, in the same at the stadium where, I mean, Shad Khan owns it, right? This is that was the Jaguar Stadium where they were playing at. That happened there as well. It's crazy. I mean, not crazy, but Kanye West is not like a political figure, really. I mean, I know he ran for president, but kind of as a joke. It's just one public person to say just something brazenly anti-Semitic, and then all of this people are it's okay to do. I mean, or they're broadcasting it.
That's the way it works.
Yeah.
I wonder if Candace Owens is like now, like, I wonder like what Candace Owens is thinking about in terms of
false
like,
flags. You know, it's the left trying to
exactly
like, how Hitler was misunderstood. I think that's probably what Candace is thinking.
Right.
And this one was the one right outside the stadium.
Oh, why do you want to
take a like, have they said? Is
now this one looks like it's projected on there, right?
Yeah.
But on that building, it doesn't look like it was projected. It looks like it was on like the building's like electronic billboard.
If that was projected on that building, it's pretty impressive projection technology. Because where are they projecting it from?
Like, yeah,
it
must have been. I don't think so. This looks like it's projected just from the floor because you can see it on top. Like I think, but I don't know for sure. But
Kanye's going out there and he's, I mean, the clip is almost just humor. It's not humorous, but he's so, you can't take him seriously, obviously. He was saying that a Jewish doctor was telling him to take his bipolar medication and now he's freed from the Jews because he's not taking the medication anymore. Anybody who's watching that goes, okay, this is somebody who does not know what's going on and is not tethered to reality. But that's not really what these bigots and anti-Semites need. They just need someone with a little bit of a public profile to say something anti-Semitic, and then it's you know, off to the races. And right-wing politicians have been greasing the wheels for this for a while with all this globalist kind of talk and elites and things like that with coded language. But now it's just out there, and it's paper thin between open anti-Semitism and it all being a little bit more concealed.
The House GOP, Judiciary GOP, on October 6th, so not even a month ago.
Ranking member Jim Jordan of Ohio.
Tweeted out, Kanye, period, Elon, period, Trump, period.
Yeah. Yep.
It's still up. It has not been tweeted.
Judiciary GOP.
Yeah, send that to me. I might want to retweet that.
Let's play this clip number 12. Couple of things to talk about. In terms of like the trans bigotry in this country, and the idea that like, you know, we have an authoritarian state. When you look across the country, in terms of what's authoritarian, it's not college students protesting that they don't want to hear from Ben Shapiro on campus. It's not, you know, the wokes. If you want to talk about genuine authoritarianism, we want to talk about government imposition of an ideology. In Florida, we are literally just days away from Florida banning any type of gender-affirming care for minors under the age of 18. Doesn't matter what the parents say. Doesn't matter that it's puberty blockers. I mean, on some level, this is going to end up hurting people who take some of these medications for other reasons. But nevertheless, the evidence is quite clear that when you provide this care, you are diminishing suicides. You are diminishing suicide ideation. You are making the lives of hundreds, maybe thousands, some instances, maybe across the globe, millions of children better. But there's enormous bigotry that is spreading because it has the electoral salience. And of course, you know, the sort of like the people who are just worried about the excesses of trans ideology. But this is one end of it. Here is Columbia, Tennessee resident Jesse Graham. She's at the Board of Trustees meeting in Columbia, Tennessee. A county library director in Tennessee was fired for refusing to take down a gay pride themed books display because these religious fanatics do not want in any way the idea that people may have a different sexual orientation than what their Bible says that they're supposed to have, or may have a different perspective on gender than what they have. They don't want it to be normalized at all. They want these people ostracized and to be made pariahs of.
I've never been sexually assaulted at a drag show, but I have been at church twice. The men in that church told me it was my fault. This whole scenario should have stopped at the United States of America, where we have free speech, but it didn't. We're here. And it's so ironic that he also served in our military that guarantees us these freedoms, and he is here. Moved from another place to come here and tell us that a community that we love, we are related to, we are friends with, they babysit our kids, we work with them, that they're dangerous. That's bull. They haven't done anything to anyone. And I am so sick of listening to this weird, fake, pious crap about Christianity being the reason behind we have to cut the kids. Jesus didn't go anywhere and condemn people. He did not ever walk into any place and spew hatred and lies and completely annihilate a group of human beings who just want to exist.
I mean, that woman is a hero.
Love her.
That's a real American right there.
Yeah. And she's talking about that county commissioner who's been leading the charge, but
who apparently he runs a local organization called the Foundation for Liberty and Freedom, and he was concerned that the materials were quote unquote child targeted. That's Maury County Commissioner Aaron Miller.
Which just goes to show you that all of that is bullshit.
Yeah, liberty and freedom, which is why we are going to censor this.
Florida is going to ban is going to prevent doctors and parents from agreeing on treating any children under the age of 18, puberty blockers, hormone treatments, any type of gender-affirming surgery, which, of course, is extremely rare and would only happen after years of consultation and therapy and in addition to these other measures. Some board had essentially a public hearing where they refused to hear from most of the people, and they had a bunch of fake doctors in there. The American Academy of Pediatrics wrote written testimony against the proposed rule. The American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association support gender-affirming care for transgender minors. All of these medical associations dedicated to assessing the validity of treatment and the efficacy of treatment. Completely irrelevant in this decision because we've got to protect the kids. And somewhat related, we're seeing this all around the country. We're seeing it all around the country. It really is nuts. It really is. And this is all, and this is not going to go away. It's going to be, unless it like proves completely ineffective for the Republicans in this run up to the election. It's not going to go away. It's not going to go away at all. What else should we do? Do we have one other one that we should do?
We can talk about Don Jr. tweeting that thing out about Paul Pelosi.
Yeah, let's, well, let's start with Chris Sununu, who's on, who's on with Chuck Todd. There's a couple of things to be said here. It is the case that Kavanaugh and Sotomayor both were subjects of attempted, or at least, you know, the nascent attempt at some attack on them. Obviously politically inspired. Steve Scalise was shot at a congressional baseball game by someone who I think was politically motivated. The difference is that you cannot find a Democratic lawmaker, a Democratic candidate. I don't think you can find even like people who do what we do, who say things like Marjorie Taylor Greene did at a speech where Nancy Pelosi is guilty of treason and the punishment for treason is death. Or let's hang Mike Pence. Or just the response from supposedly the responsible leadership. Here's Chuck Todd with Sununu. Let's just give you like the range of responses to this. This is the best that you're getting out of it. Because remember, he's from New Hampshire. Where they're like the closest like you can get to some type of moderate Republicans, I guess.
You had to cancel your outdoor inauguration in at the start of 2021. It was the day after the January 6th attack. You talked about direct threats against your family. I think it was your COVID policies that seemed to fire up some people to do these threats. Look, you've had to deal with this. Where do you think
threats came from? The right, incidentally,
political violence is coming from.
Well, look, you can go back to the beginning. This started back in the summer of 2020, right? When you saw cities burning, you saw not a whole lot of accountability there. The line for folks that were disagreeing with what might have been happening, not happy with what's happening in their communities, the line completely moved with very little accountability. And that set kind of a new standard in a very dangerous way. And then that carries over into the politics and what happened in 2020, the insanity of what we saw in January 6th. What has happened to Steve Scalise, that was years before 2020. The threats on Justice Kavanaugh. No, Gabby Giffords, I mean, there doesn't seem to be an end to this. It's on both sides of the aisle. But look, people have to just take the heat down here. I mean, this is America. This is one of the most amazing places on the planet Earth. We should all wake up and be grateful. We can disagree and have heated arguments, of course. But when you cross that line into violence, it does your cause no good. It does the system no good. And it just brings everything to a more fragile state.
All right, let's just be clear here. It doesn't occur to like Chuck Todd to say like, it seems like you're just sort of spitballing here, because your whole premise was this is a function of protesters in 2020, and that the protests ended up inflicting property damage on places. And that basically said open season to go after political figures. And then all of a sudden you remembered like, oh, wait, but much of this happened before then. So that's not a function of that. It has nothing to do with the rhetoric Look
what you made me do, politics. This is like a, one of my favorite themes to hit back on about the Republican Party. It is they are never the source of their own violent rhetoric or extremism. It's always because the left made them be that
way. Of course. And here's Chuck Todd, who wants to bring it back to Trump. But in fact, like, we had, was it Cornyn? I can't remember which senator it was from Texas who, I think it was 10 years ago, was saying, like, I don't blame people if they want to go shoot a federal judge because of all the way that these black-robed people are. I mean, there's no historical context for this, or that is presented by the news. Like, he's on the floor of the Senate justifying an assassination attempt against the federal judge. I don't know, it was 10 years ago or what. Maybe it was more. Play this.
Former President Donald Trump and all of this?
Oh, there's connection to everybody in all of this. No,
oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Everybody. Look,
it's not just about former President Trump. It's about, I mean, people are getting upset about inflation. They're getting upset with, you know, issues that happen on what we would consider a very minor level. But to them, it's passionate. It's the end. It's just the end of days for them. And they're going to go to that nth degree. And it's just absolutely insane. It is. And again, the answer isn't just, well, we're just going to have more security. Of course, you're going to have to do that at some level.
All right. I don't need to hear anymore. This is like the idea, like, oh, yeah, no, it's Trump. It's like everybody. And he couldn't even come up with it's Trump on one side, but it's also inflation. Both these things can drive you to try and assassinate somebody with a hammer.
Break into somebody's house.
I mean, if the left gets lefty enough.
Look what you made them do.
But at least we're getting, you know, that's the best answer you're going to get out of a Republican.
Oh, yeah.
That's the best answer. Like, you know, Trump, but also inflation.
And he'll be the one who's more representative of Republicans in the media's mind than, you know, one of the top Republican influencers in the Republican Party.
Well, former advisor to the president himself.
This is
what he does. The internet remains undefeated. Also,
oh,
if you switch out the hammer for a red feather boa, you could be Hunter Biden in an instant. This is
someone who's dressing as Paul Pelosi for Halloween, which is a
underwear and a hammer.
Doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah,
Paul Pelosi's attacker, not Paul Pelosi. But
right,
anyway.
Right. Why
well,
would
no,
that
this
be
is
Paul
because
Pelosi?
of the immediate conspiracy that was pushed by everybody, you know, whether it was Donald Trump Jr. or, you know, Jimmy Dore or whomever, that obviously this was a secret affair.
Yeah, it was probably gay people did it.
It was probably gay people. Yeah, that was the one thing that stuck out with Dore's thing. It's like, I'm sure it wasn't gay sex. And like, why didn't you just say sex? Like, people can figure it out. If it's two guys, we can figure out that. Like, what are you going to say, like, gay sex for? Like, it wasn't like he was having an affair with the guy. But it has to, like, you know.
He's old. I mean, old in his perspective. But,
We're the same age.
I know. I'm sorry. But who, I apologize. Who do you think is a more popular figure in the Republican Party with voters? Donald Trump Jr. or Chris Sununu?
I'm going to just go for Donald Trump Jr.
Don Jr. is like polling as someone who they think should run for president.
Yeah, I'd love to see how many campaign itineraries for candidates that Don Jr.'s on relative to Chris Sununu.
Mm-hmm.
Can't imagine Sununu's going out and campaigning for Herschel Walker for Dr. Oz or Blake Masters.
All right, a couple more IMs and we're out of here. Adam from Indiana. I got to go do some trick-or-treating with my kids. LDJ5 sounds like an awesome Latin disc jockey name. Chittown Lefty. HR person here. Employees' data needs to be retained for 7 years. Legally, Amazon probably takes advantage of this for communicating to the union. Team Buster. Sam, out of curiosity, how far in advance do you usually book guests? I imagine it depends on the guest and the topic, but what's the typical range? We don't have a system like that.
Some kind of depends on the day, or like depends on what's relevant or pertinent. Because sometimes we'll just
some we may have booked 3 weeks out,
right?
Some not.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what,
if
our
they have books, it's probably more a longer time in between the booking and the
And we were going to have Chris on before, but you were sick. Yeah. So
Dave from Jamaican, Twitter dead in a year, replaced by new version software else. Sam, you are the only normal divorced dad.
Maybe that's well, that might honestly. Be
I'm
the
not
case.
Even sure. No,
we got some more normal divorced dads. Shout out all the normal divorced dads in the audience.
I have
all the normal
one.
Divorced dads in the house. Southern accent. We all love Jews so much. We're letting them house it until the rapture. Catfish James. It's wild to me that Amazon did not take Christian more seriously. Listening to this interview, he's clearly not only incredibly intelligent, he's clever and personable. I hope he continues the good fight.
Racism and classism. They looked at him and they thought, oh, we got this, and not realize that the way he is, just the Chris Smalls of him is really useful in talking to people that work at those warehouses.
Seymour Buttocks. Please finally clip and release Jimmy Doorknob Call as a Halloween spook. Oh, yeah, we'll get to that. I know. I keep promising. Dan for Columbus. Did Doug Mastriano's wife get confirmation from the Pope of the Jews that she loves Israel more than some Jews? Well, look, we've heard Ben Shapiro has said the same stuff. Donald Trump said the same stuff. Like, in fact, Ben Shapiro's gone even further, where he's been like actively criticizing like the secular Jews, as he calls them, that don't love Israel and don't practice Judaism in the way that he does. And frankly, it was like, that's what you hear from the Christian Zionists. And, you know, only because it's relevant when talking about anti-Semitism, that was Hitler had the problem with. The problem was with the cosmopolitan Jews, not necessarily the ones who were super religious, because they stay with them themselves. Mm. They don't come out and infect society. And that is a longtime cri de coeur of the anti-Semites. And I'll have you know, too, that you can find Jews who look at Ben Shapiro and go, hey, dude, what's with the shaving? What's with the shaving in these 5 points? You're not supposed to shave. You're not a real Jew. Like, we don't have a pope. There's no good Jew, bad Jew deciding committee. That doesn't happen. He can go F himself.
Not the Daily Wire?
No. Slappy Tubbs. Wow, Obama, where were you on Social Security when you were president? Oh, right. You proposed to cut it. Yes, we went through that. Jason MN. Phone's on? No, so sad. So is Bolsonaro actually stepping down? I don't see how he couldn't at this point. Road Rider. Without Social Security that I paid into since I was 16 years old, I'll have to drive a truck until I die. All right, four more. Snake Balloon. Tommy Tuberville once left a group of Texas Tech recruits at a restaurant when he found out that he got the head coaching job at Auburn. Oh, what a piece of garbage. Jack Black Robin. Sam said, where's my sound sheet? And I couldn't unhear Michael's anti-Semitic impression of him. Tim from Minneapolis. The Nevada caucuses were February 22, 2020. Mm. Ted Cruz is probably less likable, but it's close.
That was the first time I remember really getting worried about COVID, and I was in Nevada for the caucuses, and then I went to LA, and then I was supposed to fly out for my first vacation in 2 years on the 12th, and the night before Trump declared a national emergency, so we did not go to Puerto Rico.
Sam's mailman. Speaking of governmental change, increasing the health and height of citizenry, the same thing happened during the progressive era in the United States. U.S. citizens were shorter and sickly during our first Gilded Age. Add that to your quiver next time a libertarian cites the 1800s as a golden age for capitalism while disavowing slavery. Jules Winfield, Chris Smalls is my hero. I tell every worker who will listen to the story of how he led a movement against the most powerful company in the world and ended up winning. But Chris is on point about how the movement is still in its infancy and that we need laws that actually protect workers. There's a ton of workers I meet regularly here in Chicago, supposedly a big labor town, who feel like they're being taken advantage of or even being abused. Most have no clue that they have an option or feel that a union is just a pipe dream. It's great to see Chris out here letting regular folks know that there's something they can do and that there are people who care, people who've actually been in their situation. The man is an inspiration. I'll tell you that Illinois referendum on making it a, basically enshrining the union protections and right to form a union are a big deal. That's going to be helpful in Illinois for that very thing. All right, the final IM of the day. I've seen instances where F.U. Trump was projected onto a large building from a projector mounted in the back of a pickup truck. They could drive around and blast any words onto any building and then drive away after a minute or two. I suspect this is the case. Modern projectors can easily project perfect straightforward fonts from crazy low angles anywhere on a building. All right, fair enough.
I mean, that's wild because it looked like there was something on that top. Yep. And is that the way top of the building, too?
Yeah. That's I don't know. I'm suspicious, but maybe we'll do a little more research. Bradley, Matt, Emma, great job today. Folks, see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the lie.